Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello, and welcome to episode 74 of the Carpcast. How are we today, Mark?
Oh, I've just finished work. I'm sat in the living room. I've got my stinky feet up on the table next to the microphone, so my apologies if any of the stench works its way through to your end. And I'm looking outside thinking, I've got a nice sweet little 10-foot rod in the garage. I need to get it sorted out for some floater action.
Yeah, the weather's been pretty nice, hasn't it? It's been pretty nice where I've been, because I had a week in France on Cavaignac, and which was the Lake Nash used to own about 10 years ago, now run by the French guy David, who some people will know. He used to bailiff it when Nash was there. He now part owns it, or part leases it, with the Mr. Cavi, the French guy who lives at the bottom of the lake. And we went, well, via Amsterdam, we went straight to Ibiza for 4 or 5 days partying straight from there. So I'm away quite a lot over the next couple of months. Well, I've got, I'm at home for 4 weeks, and then I'm doing my big sort of European visiting and fishing trip. So we are testing out my mobile setup at the minute. So I've got Skype linked to me 4G, which is linked to my phone, so I'm not relying on any internet, and so far it seems to be working. I've got my little portable Go mic, and this is a test run to make sure that we can still keep Carpcast going while I am on holiday. And it's working, apart from those big bassy thuds you keep doing in my ears with your mic.
I'll take my feet off the table, shall I?
Yeah, so everything's working. Just go over my French trip. It was fantastic. We arrived at Cavaignac. We flew there. So have you ever flown to a lake and not took your fishing gear? Have you ever done that?
I've never done that, no.
Yeah, it feels a bit weird, because, like, I don't know about you, but I take everything by the kitchen sink, and sometimes the kitchen sink if I've got my van with me. And it's, you know, I've got stuff that I never use, but I know that I've got it. So, you know, should I come into a situation where, you know, I need to tie up I've very rarely used chods or naked chods, but I carry all the bits to make it with me. And when you're going somewhere that you're flying, you know, I've stripped it down to a small tackle box, essentials only, and you know, was ticking off a list of how many things I forgot once I got there. So it was quite scary. A couple of panics. I thought I'd forgotten a fourth reel, but I didn't. I had it with me. It was just in a different bag. I think I forgot, bear in mind I've been using Ronnie rigs for pretty much everything at the minute, I forgot the rubbers that go on the hook, because I've only just started using them. You know, the rubbers that stop the ring swivel or whatever you're using on the hook from falling off. I forgot those. Luckily, Reedy had a pack of the original Nash ones that he's had for years. So I swiped those off him, because I went with Reedy, who runs the angling show with us, and also with Spenny, who also is one of the partners in the angling show. So, yeah, it was a bit of a post-show trip, something we'd arranged with David, because he was at the show, and wow, what a trip it was. Spenny had a gig on the Saturday, so a lot of these holidays where you fly, they run Saturday to Saturday, including the two holidays we do, the VIP Carp holidays. We do a couple of family holidays, both sort of fairly southern France, one's near Limoges, and the other's a little bit further away, but still within a couple of hours of Limoges, the River Lot. Both fantastic holiday places with villas, and you can drive and survive if you would like to, but the advantage of those sort of holidays is you will be picked up from the airport, and you don't have to do the mega long drive. Check out vipcarpholidays.com or have a look at the Facebook page, should you wish to check those. But David picked us up from the airport. I've lost my thread there. completely got distracted, so as we were talking, trying to promote VIP. But Spenny had a gig in, I think he was gigging in Scotland, so he had to get a flight to London from on Sunday, from Scotland to London, then from London to France, hire a car, and then drive the couple of hours to the lake. We already got there on the Saturday. Reedy picked one swim called the Sanctuary. I went in a swim called the Chateau, which the last time we went there, I actually made a DVD on Cavaignac many years ago. If you've got my DVD, The French Connection, that is actually filmed on Lake Cavaignac. I think we went like the end of March, about 7 or 8 years ago or something. So I'd fished it before, but Reedy picked what was probably one of the best swims, or usually the best swims sort of through the general year. Fishes a lot of the open water, and it's full of pads, absolutely fantastically beautiful looking lake. I have no vested interest in Lac Cavaignac. It's nothing to do with me. I have no commission, I don't book any holidays there or anything, but I strongly recommend it. Ideal for taking your missus or whatever as well. The facilities are pretty good there. You get a big, in fact most of it was your mob, Mark, the Chub and Witchwood. Most of the gear was theirs actually. It's quite a bit of stuff by Proline, who are a Dutch company. All the but I think the rods were Chub rods, like £3 test curve, which I used all week. The bivvies were those big two-man Chub things, you know, the like the armadillo style, pram hood style bivvies, which actually took off. And in the south of France, you can get these like flash storms that come through, and it was red hot all week except for this one day where it chucked it down my rain. And then I was lay in my shorts on top of the bed, door down, because I was watching a film that I downloaded on Netflix, and while it was raining. And it was like a roar, it was like a lion's roar, just like, came out of nowhere, and the fucking bivvy took off. It was clearly not pegged in as well as it needed to be. Obviously, all the pegs ripped out, but there's like an inner mesh capsule, isn't there, with like a built-in crown sheet on those. And obviously, my fat ass was lay on the bed chair on top of it, so it stopped it like completely vanishing over the field into the back, but enough to uproot it and get everything drenched. It was raining really hard. I'm hanging on to the bivvy for dear life. I've had to like my gear's everywhere, it's spread all over the bivvy. They're like, you get bivvy tables and everything supplied, so everything's laid out nice, you know, phones out there, everything's all over the gaff, which is now all getting drenched. I'm holding on to the front of the bivvy, I'm trying to step into like flip flops and waterproofs and stuff so that I can try and sort this out. I rang up David and said like, I need help, and he's like, no, it's impossible, the storm is past, it is fine, it is okay, you'll be fine, it's fine. I'm like, it's not fucking fine, I'm hung onto the bivvy and everything's getting drenched in the heavy weight. No, it's fine, I cannot come across in the boat, I'm cooking dinner, all the food and stuff's provided over there. I'm like, I really don't need to hear that it's fine, because it's not fucking fine. But apart from that, Spenny came round from the next swim, came round in the boat, and managed to hold stuff while I moved the bivvy and repositioned it. So, but yeah, apart from that, it was brilliant, but it absolutely kicked off in that rain. I mean, to be honest, it kicked off anyway. Reedy and I arrived on the Saturday. We he went in the Sanctuary swim and I went in the Chateau swim, which is, it's kind of like three arms. There's a body of open water in the middle, it's all full of pads, and then there's like, do you know the flag for the Isle of Man? Have you seen that? It's like three legs, isn't it, sticking on. Well, that's what the lake looks like. There's a big open water in the middle and there's sort of three long arms, one called the Channel, which is the sort of most prolific area. It's like 30, 40 plus bites a week in there. Only did about a dozen that week we were there, because the fish had moved out into other areas. They were definitely grouping up ready for spawning. We've got the arm that I was in, and got the other arm that's, it's called something different now, but it used to be called Nash Bay, and that's where most of the other guys sort of all fished that side. There's a couple of lads from your end, Mark, a couple of Yorkshire lads, caught a fair few fish early on, but it was clear that I was on the I was on the bulk of the fish. I decided not to, because everybody was like on one bank, like the lodge side. I just decided to rest the lake. We had 7 days ahead of us. Spenny wasn't coming till late Sunday night, Monday morning anyway. And I thought, do you know what? I'm the only person away from literally where everybody else is, so I'm not going to fish. I got all my camp set up, got everything ready, tied all my rigs, got all my rods ready, and thought, I'm just going to chill tonight, have a couple of beers, and put the rods out on Sunday morning at first light. I didn't get up at first light. I got up about 7 o'clock and then boated round the corner, because I was a bit cut off where I was. It was only like boat access. A lot of the swims are boat access only, but you get boats provided and you can hire motors and batteries and stuff. And I went round to see Reedy, had breakfast with him, then went and put the rods out, and I just caught instantly. It was absolute chaos. So I've tried putting four rods along the margin, which is about 250 yards away from where I'm fishing. I dropped them off with boat. I'd got three of the four rods out, and the first one went. So because you're like towing into like onto the edge of pads, sort of 250 yards away, so I was just about to do the fourth rod, so I've had to like boat back to the swim, grab the rod and the net, boat out to my spot, and then you're like tracing the line through pads. There's just no point pulling because it will just cut off, so you're like kind of like hand lining through the pads. It's years since I fished in pads. I forgot how difficult it is actually to actually get the buggers back out. You kind of like have to push the pads to the side, trace the line through. Obviously, if the fish is like zigzagged and stuff through the pads, it's a bloody nightmare. It can take half an hour of fish sometimes. So I'm going through all this for the first time in years because I've done it for ages. All I can hear is wee, and another rod's away. I'm like, fuck, what do I do now? Like, I've got this fish on, I'm in the middle of the lake, I've then got to do whatever I'm doing with this fish, then like go 250 yards back to the swim, get the other rod, then come back out, do all this that I'm doing again. Oh, it was a nightmare. Anyway, it's got a long story short, I had bite after bite after bite on that first morning, so much so that I decided not to put all my rods down there because it was just too much hassle. There was no way I could keep four rods in the water along, so I decided to fish two in open water and then just two on those pads just to make it a bit easier, because there's pads everywhere all over the lake. I'll put a picture up on our page so you can see, but every set of pads had fish in it, no matter where they were on the lake. Reedy, where he was fishing, like one of the tricks from when they fish years ago is you actually push the rod, like you wind the lead right up to the tip of the rod and you push the rod underneath the pads and then let go of the bail arm, let it drop to the deck, because it's quite hard under the pads and everywhere else is very soft silt, and the fish just live in the pads. So that's kind of like a technique. Most people go right up to him, but Reedy was just going right in him. He said that's obviously, he lived out there for weeks when he used to work for Nash many years ago. So yeah, little pads trick if you're boating. The fish are going in the middle of the pads anyway, even if you drop it on the edge of the pads, they're going into the pads as soon as you get the bite. So makes no odds if you're just going to drop it in the pads, just get a bite quicker, that's all. Anyway, I think I had 10 fish in the first 24 hours. After finding spots and baiting it on the first night and then just not fishing. And I wonder how many people do that, you know, on a foreign holiday when you got a week ahead of you. Let everybody else stress the lake out, everybody else get sorted. And it was so obvious for me to do it because I had no lines anywhere near me. Like, everybody was kind of all at one bank. It was just the perfect time to do that, to rest it. And I don't know if the fish were there anyway, up my bit, but by the end of the week I think everybody caught. There was a couple of guys, English guys who live in Spain, they're on a bit of a family trip, a couple of brothers and the dad, they'd driven over from Spain, and they were probably in the worst swims, but they wanted to be by the lodge because they were cooking amazing meals every night in the lodge, and they wanted to be there whether the fish were there or not. I think they'd been there quite a few times in the past, and even they, by the end of the week, had had a fair few fish, including a few 40s. I think pretty much everybody caught 40 pluses. I had, I forget how many fish. I was top rod by a country mile. Reedy caught up. He had like a 24-hour period where it went crazy for him, where he had like there was what it was the night that it rained and my bivvy got took off. Reedy had like 10 bites. overnight between him and Spenny, just from like 5 o'clock in the evening to 6 o'clock the next morning. They had at least 10 bites one night. But I could have had double the amount of bites that I had if I had somebody else in the swim with me, because most of the swims are double swims. If I'd have had somebody else in there with me, I'd have caught twice as many. But I was not putting all my rods in the sort of bite areas, just because it was too much hard work on my own, and I couldn't be out. I didn't want three rods in the major bite area and then and be out in the boat, you know, with a fish on, and then one of the other rods going, like it happened on the first day. It was just chaotic. So, which if somebody else was on the bank to pick the rod up and, you know, stop the fish going further into the pads, then, you know, I would have done it. I'd have had more rods down there, or we could have shared all the bite spots between us. My swim would have done two or three times the amount of bites if there was two of us in it, rather than one. But you haven't done much fishing abroad, have you, Mark? But I strongly recommend that one, or we can maybe get a carp cast trip there next year or something.
Yeah, my fishing abroad is limited to crab lines on the end of the beach.
Yeah,
telescopic rod. Never actually done it for carp, but to be honest, I spent that much time and money doing fishing over here, it's not really left a lot. And when I've gone on holiday, it's been with a wife, usually to Florida or Iceland.
Yeah, you like going back to those places, don't you? I mean, it's the sort of place you could take your missus. She just wants to sunbathe and relax. You know, there's not a lot to do around the lake unless you had a car and went visiting. But, you know, don't feel missus is sort of... But if anyone out there has got a missus that's happy just sunbathing, you know, out on the bed chair, get your food delivered to you every day, breakfast in the morning, evening meal and dessert, and you know, it's pretty comfortable. And it's a beautiful lake, but and the fact that you can fly there, you know, it's nice. I don't think there was any 50s out while we were there. There was a lot of 40s. I had, I think I had like five over 45. I had a fair few 40s. I think the smallest fish I had was 36. Mid 30. There was a few that I unhooked in the boat and didn't take back, but they all looked 35 plus. And at least half the fish I had were 40s, I think, or 40% of them maybe. Sort of 40s to 48 was the biggest I had. I think I had three different 48s. But yeah, it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience, and not quite as enjoyable. But we had to get two flights on the following Saturday. Good job Spenny had the car, because we drove back to the airport the following Saturday, because we had to go. In fact, we went Friday night, got a hotel in Toulouse on the Friday night. Otherwise, we could have gone back with David on Saturday morning. But yeah, we went back with Spenny. We had to fly to Amsterdam to get a connecting flight to get to Ibiza. And yeah, Spenny, he's got a brand called Kaluki, which does sort of big nights around the world. And he had a night at the Blue Marlin on the Sunday night. A DC-10 opening party on the Monday. And do you remember me telling you a story some time ago about being in the Funky Room in Pasha in Ibiza about 7 years ago and being tapped on the shoulder by a certain owner of Corda, Mr. Danny Fairbrass?
I remember you telling me that one, yeah.
Well, the same thing happened again. I'm at DC-10. Yeah, I'm at DC-10 opening. We've gone there quite early because we all got walked in. Shout out to Nick Yates, who works for Circa Loco. Managed to get a group of about 20 of us in early doors. We've gone in at like 4:30 in the afternoon. Ben Mike's open till 7 o'clock the following morning, so it's a pretty long stint. It's like a 16-hour stint, 17 hours if we did the lot. But yeah, we've got in at 4:30. About 5:30, we're all sat there in the sun. It's pretty early doors. It's not... It's not rammed at this point. There's 400 or 500 people in there. We're all in the courtyard outside. And somebody tapped me on the shoulder, spun round, and it's Danny Fairbrass. And obviously, I recognised him this time. Because I think the first time was a bit wasted. And I knew him, but I didn't know who it was. But yes, we ended up spending the whole evening with him. I'll bang a picture up again on our... Facebook page or something. But yeah, ended up spending the evening with Danny and Andy's lovely wife, and yeah, we had a fantastic evening in there. I bailed about 2 o'clock in the morning, which is, it's still a long stint if you got in there at 4:30. You ever been in a club for 10 hours? It's quite a long time.
No, not in a club, but similar sort of time scales when I've done festivals in the past.
Yeah, that is, it basically is, isn't it? It's a one-day festival, yeah. somewhere like that. Yeah, but we had a fantastic time. I feel like I've done loads of fishing this year. I feel like I've done more fishing than I've done in years. And
you
I've
have?
Been, and I've actually caught, which is... yeah, which is...
it's phenomenal, really.
I know, yeah. I'm not used to it.
To the Ronnie rig.
I tell you what, talking about the Ronnie, it's a bit too good, that fish. A lot of the hook holds I had in France were so nailed, it was struggling to get the hook out. I had to start taking the forceps with me. Heapy Bob made a comment actually when I posted this on one of the Ronnie rig discussions. How many anglers actually carry forceps with them? Do you have them?
Yes, permanently, all the time.
Yeah, they're fairly essential for unhooking fish. Now, until I started using the Ronnie rig, I don't think I've needed them that much. To unhook a fish, I probably need them one every 50 fish to actually unhook it. But every single bite with this Ronnie rig, and it's not a phase. I'm never one to jump on fads. You know, I've got on Zigs 5 years late. I got on the Chod rig 4 or 5 years late. I still don't really like the Chod, but I'll use it where it has to be used. I am not a bandwagon type person. I'm the opposite. You know, I will do myself out of fish by ignoring the going method rather than jump on a bandwagon. I am the opposite. But that Ronnie rig is so good. And I actually think it's bordering on dangerous. There is hints of double hooking, not like the bent hook rig. Not quite as extreme as the bent hook rig, but the hooks are in so far, they're definitely coming out the other side.
Are you using the twister style hooks or the way the curve shanks?
I've used them with twisters. The few fish I had out of Acton when we were on there a few weeks ago, I had a couple of decent ones, like a 36 and a 40, I think. They were with twisters. I didn't have any big twisters when I went to France. I didn't have time to get an order in, so I did have a load of size 5 Fang X's, which are a slight bend. They're not as bent as like your gardener hooks and stuff that they're using the Ronnies with, but they have got a decent bend to them. I know you used the Fang X's for a long time, didn't you, Mark? Very tough hook.
On and off, yeah. I'm talking, you know, pre-twister days, you know, 20 years back when it was... I don't know if they even called Fang X back then, but there was in like a little blue packet with like a cartoon snake, I believe.
That's right, yeah. The Fang X is a great hook, especially a great hook for abroad. I used to use them a lot until I sort of started using the twister. The twister, as you know, you can use it for literally every rig, from a choddy to a a blowback rig to a pop up to a Ronnie to everything. But the two types of quick change clip that Nash do, they do a micro one and a normal one, and the normal one's perfect for that size 5. Like, still the thing I like about the Ronnie is it's so easy, so quick and easy to make it. You literally, the clips are the perfect size, they don't bend or anything, they're not out of shape once you've pulled it through the eye of the hook. One post I did notice, I've seen a few posts by, you know, well-known anglers where, you know, this sticky out bit of the quick change bit, so you've got like the little bent hook thing, haven't you, that you pulled through the eye. I've noticed some people putting pictures of the Ronnie rig up where the sticky out bit, i.e. the metal end of the of the quick change bit, is like facing inwards, you know, like on inside the hook as opposed to outside the hook. This is clearly dangerous because it can damage fish's mouths. Even when you've got shrink tube or silicon or whatever you're using on it, obviously if you've got like a spike sticking out on the inside. And I hadn't really thought about it when I first started making them. I just automatically put it the other way with the, you know, the spiky bit pointing out behind the hook, and instead of on this sort of inside bit that's always touching the fish's mouth. But yeah, it's a little safety note. I saw a thread about it the other day, and they'd copied up a load of sort of name anglers with their versions of the Ronnie rigs, and it seemed like a lot of people hadn't paid attention to it. So, you know, they'd made five rigs, put a picture of them, three of them were pointing in and three of them were pointing out. But if you're making them, they need to be pointing out, and then you need to protect, because the Nash ones fit so nice that you could actually use them without any sort of any covering over the, you know, without any shrink tube or any silicone. But I looked at it and thought, these fit so snugly that I don't need anything on it. And I suddenly thought, you don't need it catching in the net. I was catching a lot of fish, so even if you just unhook the hook link and leave the fish in the net, when you, if the fish like flaps or when you pick the net up, you don't want anything where the hook can actually catch on the side of the net. So if you don't pull some shrink tube or some silicone over to protect that bit that sticks out, then you know, you can do even more damage to a fish's mouth. So yeah, one thing I've learned now, I've had a hell of a lot of bites on the Ronnie, and you know, over the past sort of 2 months, a hell of a lot of bites. You know, like normally 3 seasons worth of fish for me, if I'm fishing the normal sort of low stock lakes that we fish. It's not often I catch more than 10-15 fish a year on, you know, in the sort of fishing that we do. But you know, I've had 3 years worth of fish, and I've that Ronnie rig, I think it could be dangerous in the wrong hands, put it that way. That's what I'm saying. But yeah, going back to the actual equipment for making it, those size 5 twisters and Fang X's, the normal size quick links that Nash do, are absolutely perfect. I've not had one go on me yet. You know, I'm obviously checking them, because I'm sure there'll be a faulty one somewhere in the pack. That was my original concern, if you remember, with the Ronnie. But yeah. I don't know, it's such a good rig. And then obviously when you go into the smaller hooks, the 7s I normally use with the twisters, the micro one, it's not quite a snug fit. It does open out very slightly, but you just bite it back in with your teeth once you've pulled the quick change clip through. But I'm going to have an experiment with, I think the weakest link of these rigs is the actual quick change thing. Now with these smaller ones, you'll probably never use them again, if you know what I mean. You could, the bigger ones, you can actually, like the size 5s and stuff with the standard quick change thing, you can actually take the hook off. If you damage the hook or whatever, or put the point over or whatever you've done to it, the clips are solid enough to take the hook off and just pull another one on. With the micro ones, they do bend very slightly when you put them on, and by the time you've got the hook off, you're not reusing it. So I suddenly thought, why am I using a quick change rig on those? There's just no need for it. I believe the original Ronnie rig, it was actually tied with some braid, you know, the swivel was tied to the hook. And I actually think there's nothing sharp, if you use an ordinary ring swivel and tie it to the hook with some braid, I think it's a much safer rig. So I think with the smaller ones, I'm going to start doing that, just use normal swivels or ring swivels, and tie it, which I'm sure must help with the you know, with the potential danger for the sharp bits catching in nets, or damn, you know, if people can't put them on the wrong way then either, and have the sharp bits sticking on the inside to potentially damage a fish's mouth. But as far as the effectivity of them, oh my goodness.
Effectivity.
The effectiveness.
I like that word.
Yeah, it must be a word. Yeah, the effectiveness. Damn amazing. And I'm not a bandwagon type of person. I'll cut my own nose off to spite my face rather than jump on a bandwagon. But
have you never invented a rig? Have you played a dog caught with something that you think, wow, that's ace?
Well, one of our friends, Matt, he's been posting a version of the Chod rig where he's got the a swivel sliding up and down the stiff bit. Have you seen that?
I've seen it, yeah. He's let the cat out of the bag, apparently.
Yeah, except for, you know, we have spoke about doing exactly that when we were talking about Roger Bacon's, you know, the long sliding Ds, you know, when Roger, 15 years ago, probably more than 15 years ago, was looking at that rig. We did try versions of it with the pop-up on the stiff bit. You've seen people using it years ago?
I have, yes. On the rope that one of the lads was using. So I actually saw it hung up on his rods, which he quickly moved when he seen that. I've seen it.
Yeah.
We need to come up with a carp cast rig for everyone to use, don't you reckon?
Well, just get a rig someone else has been using on the quiet, put it in a magazine and give it our name, which is, seems to be what happens with them.
I'm going to go through some old rig books from 20 years back, get two of the rigs, do a bit of a mash-up, give it a new name and we'll take credit. What do you reckon?
Nah, I mean, nobody can reinvent the wheel, especially with fishing. There's some very smart minds in fishing and people way more technical than me that have thought about stuff for a lot of years. And I think one of the reasons why I've never tried to name a rig is because I'm pretty sure whatever I think of, someone's already done it. So, you know, I wouldn't want to put myself up to be shot down with somebody come out of the woodwork and go, I've been using that 25 years. The only rig I really want to know, do you remember, this is 15, 20 years ago, in the Conningbrook fish days, what's his name, the secret guy, he owns the big fish water in the Cotswolds, what's his name? It's gone out of my head. We spoke about him on the Mark Bryant episode. You know, the Mark from Baitworks.
It's not the dude who did the caster thing, is it?
Why is his name gone out of my head? That's a week in Ibiza, that is. I can't think straight. But yeah,
you've poisoned your brain cells, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. I'm nearly a week home now, and my brain is still scrambled when I think about stuff. But yeah, anyway, he's got a rig that is very secretive. I believe it had to be hand placed, it was that tricky. He used to wade out on the Conningbrook many years ago. But I would like to see that rig. I think he's got a rig that's not been done before, but he's gone to great lengths to keep it very secret for a lot of years. But yeah, I mean, you know, pretty much, you know. Martin Clark had his Scorpion rig, which I'm still sure to this day he never used. It was just let's invent a weird rig.
That. The snake rig and Scorpion rig.
Yeah, and the Scorpion rig was the same sort of idea, but they pop up actually on the hook link section. But I mean, it's a very obvious thing to do it to have it on the, you know, on the stiff link. It works very well, and Matt's obviously been using it on a chod. We were using it on the Terry Hearn combi rigs. Many years ago, but shout out to Matt anyway. He's obviously been catching loads of fish with that method, but yeah, as far as I wouldn't dare put my name to something because somebody's going to come up with a picture of it. It's probably black and white, you know, because there's a lot of good minds out there in fishing.
But yeah, someone actually posted a picture up of that very rig in a packet for sale.
Really?
Yeah.
What, as in they've made it and they're selling it on eBay or something, or?
Yeah, it has been for quite a while, apparently, but we're only having a bit of fun, Matt. But,
yes, we like Matt. Matt is one of our friends. So, but yeah, it's just funny when you see stuff and, you know, it's like you might have seen it 15 years ago and then it's got a name. Yeah. I mean, Clark has come up with a few original rigs over the years, you know, his Slip D was my go-to rig before this Ronnie rig, before I tried the Ronnie rig. I know the Ronnie rig had been getting used for a couple of years before I got onto it, but I'd just kind of converted all my D rigs and all my sort of hair rigs. I'd started using the Slip D. I thought that was great, and soon as he kind of made that public, there's other people copying it and giving it their own names. You know, I've seen him have a go at companies, you know, respected companies on different threads, saying, you know, if you're going to give it your own name, at least credit me for doing it, because I genuinely haven't seen anybody else doing that Slip D until Clarkey publicised it. And there was
the same. It's a cracky little thing. I have used them occasionally myself, and when I was using lost at one time I was using the long shank hooks.
Yeah.
Your straight long shanks, not your curved things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, there's not many people come out with super original stuff.
But, you know, when you see things, you think, oh, I've seen that 50, does it just make you feel old as well?
We are old. I'm 45 in 2 months time. Been carp fishing since, I think I've been fishing since I was 9. I caught my first double figure carp, I was 11. And I was solely fishing for carp, like, with, you know, not one rod for carp and one rod on the float. I think it was 2 years later. So I was 13, I'm 45 this year, so that's 32 years I've only been fishing for carp and had nothing else. And I think that makes me old. No, I never had a split cane rod. Split cane rods were cool even when I was a kid. It was glass fibre when I was a kid. 10 foot, Sundridge? Glass fibre, anyway, that was me, the go-to cart rods. It's funny how it goes round, isn't it, now 10 foot rods and 9 foot rods are cool again. Most companies are doing one.
Yeah, I think you have to give a shout out to Mr. Blair for that and his Urban Banks and the Scope. Is it too overdramatic to call it a bit of a revolution?
Yeah, I mean,
for a lot of people,
I've seen them using the 6 foot rods and stuff as well. I don't really get down with them. The carbon's so thin on those smaller ones. I don't know, but I still want to feel the power in the rod. I still want to feel a rod that feels chunky. And I've got the 9 foot, 3.5 pound test curve scopes, and they're fantastic. Like, it feels like a normal rod. It's a very slightly different casting action if you're trying to bang a 4 ounce lead with a little bag on it. 80-90 yards, it's a very slightly different action to a 12 foot rod, but I can fish comfortably 80-90 yards with them. I would use them for everything, you know, especially if you're dropping from boats or foreign fishing. It just goes to show, I mean, we the last time I went to Cavagnac 8 years ago, they were using the Nash Hooligan 3 pound test curve rods. It's not Nash anymore. He's got a lot of his stuff from Proline and from Chubb JRC, and he's now got the 3 pound test curve Chubb rods, and I landed 20 fish on them, you know, to upper 40s, and I wouldn't have known that I was using what I presume is a cheap rod. I wouldn't have even known. Now, obviously, I'm not casting with it. You need quality if you're doing some big casting, but, you know, for dropping from boats and landing fish, the rods were great. You know, you don't need to spend 300 quid on a rod unless, you know, it only comes into if you're fishing extreme ranges and casting from the bank. I think that's the only time you really need to pay attention to the quality of your rod, I think. But yeah, it was an eye-opener, to be honest. You know, as I said, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We're only trying to catch mud pigs, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned Chubb rods. Outcast rods you were using?
I don't even know if they said a name on them. I'm sure they just said Chubb. Yeah, it was £3 on the back.
Yeah, I know we've had Chubb rods in the shop, and I've obviously seen them at shows, and I think they're vastly underrated. I think they're cracking pieces of kit myself, only having played with them and sold a few rather than used them personally. But
they were fine. I did not sat there thinking I'm using a crappy set of rods, can't wait to get my own rods back. You know, I did not think that once. They were absolutely adequate for the job they were doing, you know, catching big fish. Like I said, I weren't really casting with them. I did have a cast around. You know, I had a lead around in front of me, and I never thought, oh, these feel floppy or anything. They were fine. Shout out to Ed Berridge, Mr. Chubman.
Yes, Ed, who recently had a mid 40 common from his new syndicate, which is bloody hard. But there's something interesting that just now you mentioned Ed, and we've got no planner this week, we're doing a random. He was telling me a story how he's got his GoPro and he's just been, you know, sticking underwater on a pole and just looking at fish in round snags. And when he's shown the footage of this, looked at it and shown it to other people, there's fish down there in this, what is a low stock pit. The, you know, chunks as well, the regulars and bailies, they've never seen them before.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. And this is it's not an underfished pit, it does get a bit of pressure.
Hmm.
So what is out there? What is still out there?
I had a belief years ago when I was fishing around Shropshire a lot, and, friends with Ellis Brazier and Alex Perrin, shout out to them too. They used to run a lake over there, and they were convinced that, like, there was new fish caught every year that they'd never seen before, and, you know, it was their lake. They used to see all the fish in the close season, and you know, there's a belief certainly lower stock lakes, you know, 30-40% of the stock never sees the bank. Or they won't see the bank for a few years, and then you get a couple that get caught and another couple go missing and then, you know, turn up a few years later. It could be very true in all lakes that a percentage of the stock just don't get caught, either because of the way they feed or what they feed on. It doesn't surprise me at all. On the net, did you see somebody who had an amazing couple of days last week? George Benos, did you see that?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Oh, just a bit. Yeah, parrot at 62, and then another fish called Black Spot, which was £58 on the John Max bait.
Yeah, both of them on John Max proper carp baits, John and Sean. John's been on talking about proper carp baits. I can't remember which episode, but if you go through the back catalogue, if you're an extra member, then you'll be able to find that. Yeah, it's been that bait's been smashing lakes, but more importantly, George has had you know, the biggest fish in the country at 62. He's gone straight on to his first ever session on the... Do you know about Wingham, Mark? Do you know that syndicate?
I know it's not cheap.
It's not cheap, no, and it's got some absolute kippers in it, with that Black Spot being the biggest. It's normally £60, that Black Spot. He could have had 260s in 2 days from two different counties. As it turned out, Black Spot was 58, but my goodness. First session on a new lake, catch the biggest. It goes like that sometimes, doesn't it? When you're on a roll, you just can't do wrong years, doesn't it?
Yes. Did you go straight out and buy a lottery ticket after that?
I would have done. All I can say is make the most of it. I think twice in my life that's happened, where I've just, every lake I've gone onto, I've just caught the biggest fish, you know, for a succession. And let me tell you, it doesn't last. So just keep doing it, because you might go through a couple of lean years after that. But I've seen it happen to a few anglers over the years. You know, it's like, everything they touch turned to gold. I had it from Elstow 2, catching the mother and the twin, onto Colmere, catching most of the fish out of there, you know, which were super hard at the time. Some of them never been caught. And then on to Yateley, where I had single scale out of Yateley, but it soon dried up after that. You know, one good year, one hit wonder from a failed talk show host.
Failed radio show.
Oh, let's not go down that road again.
So yeah, have you seen anything else on the net, Mark?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Speaking of big fish, do you see what Martin Bowler's netted?
Yes, I did. I didn't even think he lives in England. I thought he lives in Thailand these days. He's got a lake over there. I know he has a business now. I thought he was relocated. But yeah, do you know any details?
Not much, just what I've you know, seen on the net, but just a great big unnamed gravel pit unknown fish. And well done to that man. But did you also see some of the crap that followed it? The fish of a lifetime. You've got people moaning that he's publicised it, and then you've even got a bait company, which Martin has never heard of, claiming credit for the capture.
I saw Martin's post. I saw his post basically saying, you know, forget the negativity, he mentioned that bait company, but I didn't see any of the actual negative stuff myself. So yeah, what was he getting slagged for catching it, or were people saying it was I don't know, were people knocking the fish, or was he just getting knocked for publicising the fish? What was it?
A little bit of both. It's just your typical keyboard warriors, and to be honest, the less attention paid to those sort of people, the better. Well done, Martin Bowler, for catching the fish of a lifetime.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long he's been fishing over here. I mean, I'm assuming it's getting out of season for Thailand now. I know the sort of winters,
there's other things to do in Thailand, isn't there?
There's a lot of good fishing in there. I'm hoping to, I don't know if I will or not, because we've got a lot on this year, but I'm hoping to go next winter. And there are so many decent lakes over there now, big Siamese carp and stuff, and we have spoke about it before, but yeah, I do think if you go over there, fishing is something you must have a go at, because you can just go for day, you know, a day session on a lot of these places. You don't fish at night anyway on them, so I would like to do it, but yeah, maybe it's slightly out of season now, maybe it gets too hot or whatever, I don't know. And Martin's over here. As I say, I know he's over in the winter because he came to the Northern Angling Show to advertise his business, but yeah, it's I don't know what how you get access to fish these sort of lakes with unknown 58 pounders in them with no names, but wow. Have you got any guesses as to where the lake might be? You don't think it's near a particular caravan park, possibly? That's the only one that I thought of.
No, I've not got a clue, to be honest, but having said that, I've not really asked around, so I don't know. Honestly don't know. Okay. But it's like anything else with that sort of thing. You just have to be plugged into the grapevine, you know, speak to the right people and listen to whispers and have the balls to go out with your rods and try them out.
Do you think there's many upper 50s knocking about that people don't know about? Apart from like private lakes, you know, like, you know, ones that are hush-hush. We know a couple of people, don't we, that have got, you know, their own private few acre lakes and that they built and bred the fish on and fed them over the years. And, you know, there are plenty of big fish around that are not common knowledge to the general public. But forgetting those, I'm talking like big gravel pits or expanses of water. Do you think there's a few upper 50s knocking about that only a select few know about?
I believe, definitely. I mean, I was driving to a lake, Wellham Estate Lake it's called, to interview John Llewellyn, which you'll hear later on in this episode. I was driving past Oakham, which is a town at the end of Rutland Water.
Yeah, I know it.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, that, you know what, I'd love to retire and carp fish that place. I'd also love an absolute mountain of bait to do it, and it's not going to happen. You're not allowed to carp fish it, and even for 3,100 acres, a lot of the banks are open. You're just not going to get away with it. But when you look into the water there, it's clear, but not gin clear. But when I read up on the history of that place, it's 40 years old. They dammed that valley because of the clay.
Mm.
It's just like massive, massive clay pit, and there is. I'm sure there's record size of most coarse fish living in those waters. They're just have a happy life unharassed by us.
Yeah,
bream, roach. And do you know where it gets its water from?
Go on.
The Welland and the Nene.
Wow.
So we know what the Nene's done in the past.
Yeah. Do you think they can ever get that big without boilies though, if they're just left to their own?
They do on the continent, and the way the climate is, and outside it, I don't see any reason why not. I mean, take a look at, I don't know, when I was on the Scout Lake, you know, there was a couple of carp in there that are just, they see boilies, but just, it's that little pressure, they probably make up 1% of their diet. And there's bream in there to almost record size that are not boily bream.
Mm.
So there is numerous examples out there. And I believe, you've got to believe,
I believe. Cool. Anything else on the net, or should we move on to John?
We've been rambling on for a bit. I think we should go on to John, because it is, you know, is it fascinating? I mean, he has, as you'll hear, he has two passions in life, both of which is, you know, taken to the nth degree, you know, to competing in the Olympics, catching UK 50s in winter, and if you like bait and bait talk, John's knowledge of bait is without boundaries. And in fact, he said to me before we had our chat that he didn't want to go, you know, too in depth in case he just started waffling and baffling people. But I just said, no, John, just let it all out. You know, I want to learn this. It was a bit selfish. I want to know all about it. And it was one of those interviews where you don't realise you're interviewing. It's just like you get so engrossed in the conversation. And oh, just listen to it. It's good. Feels like I'm in love. Just like the first time I met you. Yeah, yeah. Feels like I'm in love. Just like the first time I met you. Yeah. Now we've got all the audio sorted.
Yep.
Let's crack on. I'm sat here with the John Llewellyn at the side of Wellham Estate Lake, and it's been quite eventful so far.
It's been a fantastic start. It's unbelievable, really.
Yeah, I've been on pest control at the top end. Had four fish, two of them singles, two doubles, up to a whopping 14.
Yeah.
You've had a 40.
I did, yeah. I did like you, though, the first time I came here. First night I came, I had four, and they were all doubles as well. So
yeah.
I think if you keep catching them, and now you're in this swim down the bottom end of the lake with the wind blowing down here, I think you've got a good chance of a good one.
Yeah, it's a lovely southwesterly wind. I've got a lovely bed of pads to the left of me. Middle rod is over to the far side. Nice, it's where trees have fallen over. It's a lovely lake.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful.
Yeah, you know, it's had a lot of work done in. It's brilliant and good stock as well now.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah, Dean Hall, who runs it, he's been running it for the last sort of year or so, and he's got a great vision for the lake going forwards. He, when he took it over, it was in a right old state, and the fish were not in great condition. He's worked like a Trojan to, you know, to put the lake back to the sort of state he wants it to be, and he knows it's going to take a few years to get it where he wants it. But the fish are already putting on weight; they're looking in great condition. There's, as far as I know, there's 340s in here now. The smaller fish that are in here are putting on weight and looking big and fat, and yeah, it's got a great future, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the pictures of the fish he's seen, those, what was saying, the emperor fish, these little scaly animals.
As well as that lovely 40 pounder last night, I caught a fantastic, like a bronze wood carving.
Yeah,
it was about 9 pounds, and it was just this beautiful brown bronzy colour. It was beautiful.
Yeah, the last one I had this morning, it, well, I'll be honest, I've not said anything yet, but I made a little bit of schoolboy error. I'm fishing near pads and I forgot to tighten the clutch up, so it absolutely roared straight through them.
Yeah.
But that was, and we didn't weigh, it was, I don't know, 6-7 pounds.
Yeah.
But it was lovely colours, just that perfect shape. You can imagine it as a mid 30, it would be just look like a big gravel pit sort of fish.
Yeah. But with the treatment that Dean's been putting into the lake and the way he's looking after it, he's very keen on all the wildlife, making sure that the natural food's up to as good as it can be. Water quality's improved a lot, and you can see it in the fish. You know, the fish have got lots of good natural food to eat now, and they're stacking on the weight.
Yeah. Are they in these Jurassic snails that...
yeah, that's quite funny, that. Yeah, your snail's as big as your thumb. It's got loads and loads of those. So, yeah, there's loads of natural food. This, and I'm sure this is going to turn into a fantastic lake.
Yeah, I think it's already there, and it can only get...
It is, really.
Yeah, it can only get better.
Yeah, well, we've still got another night to go, so we'll see.
Yeah, I'm in this new swim, and I'm hopeful. Yeah, I've, to be honest, I was a bit shattered this morning. I could do with a good night's kip tonight, but I'm hoping not for one. I want one of those 40s. But anyway, that's the scene. I also say, we sat at the back of my swim. I've got three rods out. Have you got your receiver here as well?
No, I've wound them in.
You've wound them in. Okay, so there is a chance we could catch a carp live. You know,
that'd be great. Yeah.
It would be great. It's it has been done once by, well, twice, sorry, by Adam Penning and Julian Cundiff.
Okay.
Yeah. When I was sat with Ed Betteridge, we got close. His receiver's on the top of the bivvy. It went wild. We ran to his swim, and a pike had gone through his legs and bit him off.
So, well, let's hope you could be the third one to catch one live for the carp cast.
Yeah, Jules had a little double. Adam Penning had a 25, so that's to beat. That's why I like recording on the bank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why you leave it on all night long, isn't it?
Possibly. Now, you've been... you've been carping for a long time. Where did it start for you?
Crikey, yes, I have. Well, I started, like lots of people, with my dad fishing on the Thames for gudgeon and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, we lived in London, and my dad took me out to Darrenth, actually, which was where I caught my first carp by accident. Darren. Yeah, so there's a lot of history there.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, we were just fishing for whatever came along. And I put a bit of flake on, put that out there, and caught this lovely little mirror. So that was the first carp that I ever caught. But I didn't take up carp fishing then. I still fished for whatever swam until I was about, I fished for them properly when I was about 13, 14, and I'm nearly 60 now, so it's a fair while. And I sort of cut my teeth really on lakes like Taplow Gravel Pits, Moor Lane. I went to school in Burnham in Buckinghamshire, so those were my local sort of lakes, and that's really where I started my carp fishing.
Wow, what a... Well, just surrounded by what you won't know about them, but what turned out to be some of the best lakes in the country.
That's right, yeah. I do remember seeing some anglers fishing. I don't know who they were, but they had the typical of the time sort of, you know, rods on 3 or 4 foot long rod wrists and bottle tops down the bottom. And I saw them casting out these orange sized balls of whatever it was. So it was actually going on, although I didn't know what it was at the time.
Yeah, that'll probably be in the... you know, forerunner to a Tutti Frutti or something. They were, probably. Or some paste bait or...
Yeah, I mean, knowing where it was, it might even have been someone like Jim Gibbons or something. That's a sort of bit of his horns.
Possibly,
was around there. So, Yeah.
Well, so when did the big car book? Because obviously you lived around there. Is it all your life you've been there, surrounded by all these lakes?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I've always had two great big passions in my life.
Yeah.
As well as the fishing, there's been my sport to do the fencing, which I discovered sword fencing. That is, whenever I say fencing, people
not
say,
after
"What
fencing.
Is it?" Yeah, what is it? After fencing, barbed wire. Yeah. I've heard all those. No, this was épée fencing and foil fencing, and I took that up when I was a young kid. And so all throughout my sort of young years, I had these two passions: fishing and the fencing. And I had to try and sort of juggle the two to get the best out of the two.
Well, I think you pretty much have got the best out of the two. And we'll just touch on the fencing for a minute. You've done what just about everybody dreams of. You've competed in the Olympics.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I it was a sport that I loved as soon as I took it up. In fact, when I used to love all sports, football, cricket, everything. And one day, a mate of mine, one of my best mates at the time, when I was about 12 years old, 13 years old, Jonathan Cooper, his name was, if he's listening, he might be.
Is he a carper?
I've no idea. But he came to me one day all excited. He said, "Oh, it's great. I've just had a go at this fencing and you stab people." And I said, "Oh, it sounds fantastic. I want to go at that." And so I had a go, loved it straight away. And we were very fortunate that we had a fantastic coach.
Yeah.
There's, lots of kids have potential to do things and they never actually realise it because they're not in the right place at the right time or with the right person to teach them.
Yeah, I can see that 100%.
Yeah, and I was just very lucky. And our coach, the national junior team, actually came from our school, all from the same coach. So it gives you a good idea how good he was.
Yeah.
So he brought us all on, and I became very good at the fencing as a junior. I won the junior national championships. And then I was selected for the Olympics in 1980 for Moscow. So I was went from the junior team to the senior team, and then competed in Moscow for the first Olympic Games. So that was that was something.
What an experience! And what's it like? You must have like airs lined up on the back of your neck as you just that opening ceremony, just the parading.
The most amazing. It actually in Moscow. I don't know if you remember this because you're probably too young.
Oh, was that the?
There was a boycott and things that went on.
I don't know the details. I know.
Yeah, there was some political stuff going on, and basically we were. It was with Russia invading and trying to sort of throw their weight around. And we were told, well, at one point, Maggie Thatcher said that we had to boycott the Games. And the athletes said, well, look, as far as we're concerned, it's got nothing to do with politics.
Yeah.
You know, all we're doing is training. We want to do our sport. And it ended up that we were given the choice. We could either boycott it or we could go. Some people boycotted it because in the fencing team we had some military people. And they sort of felt as a military, in the military, that they shouldn't go. So some didn't go. And to show our feelings about what was going on in the world, we boycotted the opening ceremony and the closing ceremony. So we ended up going to the Olympics just for the event and then coming straight home. So in that one, I didn't get that fantastic, like you're saying, that fantastic feeling of going out into the arena and all the cameras and people shouting
and
screaming. Oh, yeah, we didn't get that. But I carried on my career in the fencing, carried on the training, and then I was selected again to go to the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1984, which was pretty amazing. And that one, we did go to the opening ceremony. And like you say, the walking through the tunnel, seeing the end of the tunnel and the lights and hearing the noise getting louder and louder and louder and louder as you get towards the opening. And as you go in, the noise is just deafening. And walking around, I mean, it's making the hairs stand up on the neck. Just thinking about it.
I could tell you're getting quite passionate.
Yeah, it was, I'll never forget that, ever. It was just such a fantastic thing. And the same in the closing ceremony as well.
Yeah, wow, and knowing you're the cream of the crop representing your country.
Yeah, it was exciting. It was fantastic. I went on after that to compete again in Seoul in 1988. So I ended up competing in three Olympic Games. There's a little story to do with fishing with that one, which is actually quite funny. When you go into this was in the closing ceremony, and normally you see everybody wandering around behind the flag that's been carried by sort of some fantastic athlete up the front, Steve Redgrave or something, and all the other athletes behind in their tracksuits. And we were told that we weren't to take any cameras or any other equipment in with us. We were just to go in as we were, and not sort of mess around with any cameras or anything. So I was determined I was going to do something. Lots of people did take little cameras in, but yeah. I thought, well, why don't I take a flag and wave a British flag about? That'd be, you know, a really nice thing to do.
So when you watch it back on video, you can see exactly where you are. This is
fine. Yeah, and so what I did was I took a, at the time, I had a pair of Andy Little telescopic carp rods that I used to carry in my fencing bag, so that wherever I was fencing to relax, I'd just walk off and find some little river or lake and just have a little dangle and relax from all the training and the stress and stuff. So for the closing ceremony in Seoul, I had this telescopic rod that I slid down inside my tracksuit trousers so I could walk into the closing ceremony without anybody seeing it. And when I got inside, I strapped this flag that was about 5 foot by 2 foot onto the end of this fishing rod, and then I'm waving it around in the crowd. And I've got some great video of, because of course all the television, the BBC and all the British television media, they all saw this with the flag and they all zoomed in on this. Yeah. So I've got this great footage of in the closing ceremony waving this British flag around, which is great memories.
Oh, brilliant. So I'm competing. Is it safe to say you've got a bit of a competitive streak then?
I have got a competitive streak, yes. I've always had a competitive streak and I've still got it.
Yeah. I remember a conversation we had a while back. It's just one of the little things you remember how when it comes to training, just like pushing yourself, because your competitor is going to be pushing himself, you've got to just got that percentage further.
I've always sort of, it was drummed into me that when in the fencing, but this is applies to any sport you do.
Yeah.
When you get towards the top end and you're they're all elite athletes, they're all at the top of their game.
You're not there by accident, mate.
You're not there by accident, and the people you're competing against, the difference between them is so small that the only real difference is mental. And it's all about the mental attitude and who really wants it a bit more than the other one. And I've always thought that, and I've always been sort of very tough mentally, and it's been driven into me to push myself.
Yeah, that can certainly be applied to fishing as well.
Yeah, I mean, and to the when I stopped the competing with the fencing and I stopped the training, I put all my effort and my energy and motivation towards what I was doing with my fishing.
Yeah.
That's sort of what happened. So basically the carp became my adversary.
Yeah. Your foil.
My foil. Yeah, very good. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Also, when you're telling me a story about a lake a lot of people will be familiar with or have heard of, Dinton Pastures.
Yeah, Dinton. Well, I lived in Reading in Berkshire for a long time when I was doing the fencing, and I started fishing Dinton, which was only 5 minutes from my home, when I was a young lad.
Spoiled.
I was spoiled.
Don't ever come to Yorkshire.
No, it's too cold in the north anyway.
It is.
So Dinton was really close, and I fished it when the fish were, they weren't first introduced, but biggest fish were just over 20 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And I caught some of them at that time. And then I stopped fishing there and I did lots of other things. And I kept hearing about the fish getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I eventually decided that I was going to have a go for these big fish. Because the fish in those lakes there, it's a beautifully managed complex. Simon Bartlam, who runs it, he really does look after the fish and the fisheries in it in a great way. And it's real quality, proper carp fishing. And so I set myself a year to go on to Dinton and try and get one of the really big, well-known fish.
Yeah.
And it's something I don't normally do. I don't normally chase after a name or a particular fish.
I hate the phrase, but bounty hunting, they call it.
Yeah, it is. I wasn't really going for one particular fish. I just wanted to get one of those real beauties.
Yeah.
And so I set my stall out for the year, decided how I was going to do it, and I concentrated just on fishing on Dinton. I didn't go anywhere else, so I was focused. I didn't have a lot of time available because at the time I was running my business, Big Carp. So so I had to and I suppose I approached it in a way that I would with my fencing. And you don't leave any stone unturned. You know, you try and go to the nth degree to make sure that everything is exactly as you want it to be.
Every percentage is covered. And
Yeah, and I still believe that. I think when you're out fishing, if you can cover all the details and put everything in your corner, you've always got more chance of succeeding.
Yeah, because if you're not doing it, someone else will be.
Yeah, yeah, and I do. I mean, people have asked me this question before, but I do sort of see the way I look at the carp when I fish for carp or any fish really is that it's a bit like an opponent, and whenever you're competing against somebody, you want to know their weaknesses and their strengths, and then try and exploit their weaknesses, and try and the more you know about the fish you're trying to catch, whether it's a carp or a tench or a barbel or whatever it is, the more you know about it, the more you understand about the water, the more you're going to succeed in the long term. So yeah, to go back to what you asked me about Dinton, so I started fishing that season. I think it's going back to late 1990s, and the season didn't start off very well for me, and I wasn't really in the right area, and I didn't know the lake well enough. So I tried to walk around the lake a lot, even though I wasn't fishing.
Yeah, is it a big lake or?
I can't remember how many acres it is, but it's a good sized lake. It's an L shape. It's not far from the M4. It runs east to west, so you tend to get, if you've got easterlies blowing, the fish tend to go down one end, and if you get westerlies, southwesterlies, they tend to go up the other end. And at that time, the middle of the lake didn't seem to be as fished as the ends. So I decided that I would concentrate on that main big area in the middle of the lake and trickle bait into the swims in that area, in the whole area, throughout the year, and concentrate on that part of the lake, which is what I did. And I started to catch some nice fish, and it culminated in January when it was... I'd been away on holiday, actually, and when I came back from holiday, one of the things that I always did was look on BBC Weather to see what the weather was going to be over the next week, and try and time my fishing for when there was a big southwesterly coming, you know, nice strong wind, low pressure, best conditions to get a bite. And went straight into BBC Weather, had a look, and 5 days' time, the pressure was dropping down to 990. It was going to be a serious southwesterly wind. There was warnings out saying, don't go out because the trees are coming down, and things. I thought, right, that's it, I'm going fishing. So, a bit of bait got trickled into the areas that I knew. So one of the things I did at the beginning of the year was to map from each swim sort of areas and walk them out. We didn't do wraps and things then.
Yeah.
We just walked. So I'd number of steps to a certain spot, so I could turn up just for a night or an evening and chuck out on a spot without making any disturbance.
Pace out, clip up, off you go.
Yeah, and away you go, yeah. And the night I went out, I was only fishing 50 yards out, but to try and get it onto the spot it took about 20 casts because it was so windy.
Yeah, like fly fishing.
It was unbelievable, yeah. But anyway, it ripped off in the night, and I was fortunate enough to catch the fantastic Bruno.
Wow, that was...
Yeah, and he was at 52.4, so that was a pretty amazing capture, really.
Yeah, just a bit. I remember, I think it was Terrian's first book, there's a picture of Adam Penn in the 39 pounds.
Yeah, amazing fish. Yeah, amazing fish. He's unfortunately died not so long ago, but he's now on display in the Land's End pub. Just down the road from Dinton. Have you seen it?
I have, yes. Yeah, we had. I was down there on John's Lake. We called in there.
Yeah.
And, is it still there? Because
I think so. Yeah, I know he's selling the pub, but I think it's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. The landlord seemed a little bit, down on the whole thing, and.
I know he was selling his collection. He had one of the best collections of stuffed fish in the country.
Oh yeah, there was Dinton. There was Bruno. Sorry.
Yeah.
There was the big common that had come from, is it Black Swan, the other lake there?
That's right.
That was on there with a list of not a very long list of captors of it.
Yeah.
I'm assuming my mate Lee Petty or Chemical Lee, for those who know him, was on there. Oh, it's not just that. There's like these cases with massive perch as well, and
it was the brain
fish.
The brain was the one that got me. It was found dead in Walthamstow Reservoir. It was 22 pounds.
Oh my god!
That was probably still didn't fight any harder than a plastic bag. But
no, I'm not a huge fan of bream because they seem to torment me. But you can't fail to be impressed with a bream of that size.
Not
that
really.
Huge.
No.
So where else is around? Just staying in England for the time being. Where else is? We've got Dinton.
Yeah.
You know,
the Thames I fished quite a lot.
Oh yeah,
I fished the Thames quite a lot, and my local lakes, like say the South Lake. I stayed within the area of where I was, really. I didn't go very far.
Yeah. So when you've got all that quality on your doorstep,
you don't have to go very far. No. Yeah. And I've always liked the challenge I've liked the challenge of the rivers.
Yeah.
I did a lot of, I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point when I lived in France, but I lived in France and I fished a lot on the River Seine, the River Moselle, the Rhone, and I just love river fishing. And Thames carp fishing is very hard. There's not that many fish, but it's a fantastic challenge.
Yeah, it's going back a few years now. Tim Paisley Angling Publications, they organised like an evening of carp up in Doncaster.
Yeah,
they had Terry Earn coming up, and you know, when Terry Earn speaks, everyone listens.
You know,
he's the man, and he's doing this talk, and it was all about, you know, fishing on the Thames, like, you know, his dad's boat, and I think the biggest fish he showed was like, you know, mid-30 or something like that. Obviously, he's caught tons of bigger fish, and
it's
one of the best slideshows I've ever seen. You know, I loved it from start to finish. Just, you know, something different.
Yeah. I love fishing the river. It's you know, the rod wraps around. You don't know whether it's going to be a barbel, chub, carp. I love that sort of fishing. So, I fished Dinton. I fished some of the day ticket waters around. I very rarely joined the clubs. I mostly fished, a few days here and there on a buy a day ticket. And that's it. And same today, really.
Yeah, I know. One thing I did take away from, I said, with Terry and slideshow with the rivers, the amount of lakes that Thames has flooded and its tributaries have flooded. Mm. There was such a mixed bag of carp in there.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, there's all sorts. When we had those big floods a few years ago, some of the fish that were in our local lakes, there was a well-known fish in Whistley Mill. A friend of mine caught it £38. So this is near Reading. Very recognisable, scaly fish. And that fish was caught, I don't know how long later, a year or 2 years later, down near, I believe, Kingston Bridge, which is, you have to go through quite a few weirs and locks and quite a few miles. So that fish had travelled a long way. And I'm sure there's lots of others that have gone in the Thames that have done exactly the same.
Yeah, I remember a story of a linear that used to be in Sonninai.
Yep.
But that was caught down in Docklands. probably got that wrong. Someone will correct me.
No, you might well be right. You might well be right.
You know, I did hear a few rumours about the eye itself afterwards, but...
Yeah, it was rumoured that one sort of came out of the lake and went into that bit of the river near Sonning and was seen down below in the stretch below. I don't know. There's lots of rumours around that sort of thing. I'm sure up where you are as well, around the Neen. And when it floods, the gull carp must get in there.
Yeah, I'm about 80 miles north of the Neen.
Oh, are you? Oh, you were talking about the Neen earlier. I thought you were near the Neen.
No, I'm up. We've got the Don, the Trents, certainly up our way. Right. You know, there's carp in the Don that have flooded in. You know, when there's that local power station, Thorpe Marsh, when that used to be operational, there was like this gin clear overflow ditch that went into the river. And the river's tidal there, so you've got this horrible dirty water, and then it's like. Wall where it just turned gin clear.
Yeah.
I've seen carp there in the past, you know, along with chub and roach. And
but the amazing
catch the damn things.
The amazing thing on the Thames, I mean, there's carp all along the Thames in different bits of it, but the Thames is tidal up to Teddington Lock. Mm. And in that semi-tidal and tidal bit, I fished a bit there, down there and more upstream. But in that bit there, you can have like flatfish and flounders and mullet and crabs as well as the carp and the other fish.
I've caught flatties from the Don, and that's a weird fight.
it's a weird fish.
Bang bang bang, like you're playing a perch, and then you think you've lost it as they're coming towards you because there's no resistance, and then it's off again. What the hell, career?
The flatfish thing, there's something that's actually interesting, because I know at some point we're going to talk about bait, but there's something interesting I'll tell you about flounders. My dad, who got me into fishing, he always had a boat. All throughout his life, he always had a boat to fish.
Yeah.
He had a boat in Shoreham Harbour, and we used to go out and fish for congers and dogfish and all that sort of stuff. And then he had a boat that he moored up in Torquay when he lived down in Devon. And when we were down there, he also had a boat in Teignmouth and the River Teign. And we used to take his little boat out and go fishing for the flounders. And just to show you, sort of, it just highlights the point about how sensitive fish are and how they're looking for particular things.
Yeah.
Because with the flounders, when we went out on his boat to fish for flounders, if you didn't take peeler crab, you basically were not going to catch a flounder. Yeah. You might get one on a ragworm, especially if you've dug the ragworm in the estuary. but they wanted peeler crab. And you could try all sorts of, we'd go outside into the sea, or out of the estuary into the sea and fish, and we'd catch the flounders there on strips of mackerel or other things. But when you went into the estuary, you had to use peeler crab. And as soon as you stuck a bit of peeler crab on, you could have been sat there for a couple of hours with no bites on something else, bit of peeler crab, in it went, and you'd get a bite and it'd be a flounder. And that applies to, it just highlights the sensitivity of the fish to certain smell, let's call it smells, or things dissolved in the water. And that applies to other fish. I mean, even carp, when they get onto natural food, you know, you can put the best boilie in the world right next to them and they'll ignore it to eat, you know, a mouthful of tadpoles or whatever it happens to be.
I was thinking, has anyone ever brought out a peeler crab boilie?
Well, yeah, if you're fishing for flounders.
But now let's start talking about bait. I know that's a big thing you've gone into. And you know, first met you through LA Carp.
Yeah.
You know, you were along with John Baker and his flavours. You were behind the boilies there. And
yeah.
I caught from the off on the krill one. It wasn't just, you know, catching carp, because you know, caught carp before. It was different. It was, there was something happening all the time, and every time I was in a situation where I thought it should happen, it happened.
Yeah.
There's even several times when I've written it off, I thought, now I'm going to start packing up, go home, see the wife. And then it ripped off just out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, so it was...
Well, the bait is, to me, is one of the big key factors in being successful in fishing of any sort. Basically, if you're, you know, you've done match fishing and other sorts of fishing, the type of bait you're using, the way you're presenting it, and particularly the way that you apply your ground bait are real important keys to being successful. And it's exactly the same in carp fishing. And it's a bit like what I was just saying about the flounders. You know, if you didn't give them a bit of peeler crab, you weren't going to get a bite. Or with carp or cyprinids, if you give them the right sort of food, the right sort of bait, they'll go for it. And that's the sort of reaction that you're talking about with the bait when you were using it.
Yeah, it was when I've had the reaction, you know, well, first used Nashi Scopex squid years back on. Mm-hmm. That was on Elsto too. Mm. And at that time it was all like particles, little bits of plastic, or the occasional, you know, bright pop-up. And I'll be honest, I got 30 key of Scopex squid with a bit of tiger nut meal added, what was released the year after as a Scopex squid plus. And I wasn't confident in doing much on it, I'll be honest. So I just dropped it in a few margin spots where I could keep an eye on, you know, one at the back of the snags. And I've done a lap of the lake, I've come back and the water's milk. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, there's something about this bait, and that's that effect that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's the sort of reaction you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how can we get that reaction every time?
Well, you can't. That's the honest answer.
That's what we want.
Yeah, I know you do. Yeah, I know you do. I mean, if I go back a little bit and tell the story as how it's happened to me.
Yeah.
I've always been fascinated by the attraction side and the bait side, because one of the reasons is when I was doing all my training as a fencer, I was involved in training 5 or 6 days a week for 20 years of my life for the Olympics. You know, it wasn't full time. I had a job as well, but I had to train at least once, sometimes twice, and sometimes three times a day. So trying to fit your carp fishing in was pretty difficult.
Yeah, you can't really go on a long session when...
I didn't do any long sessions. Yeah. That was it. You know, a few hours nicked here or there, and occasionally a night. And that was about it. So it forced me to learn about watercraft and where the fish were going to be. That was the first thing, and where I could expect them to be. So in my short bit of time that I had available to fish, at least I'd have a chance.
Yeah.
And then of course the one of the other big factors is the bait and what you're going to put on to get a bite. So I was fascinated by that, and yeah, I decided that the way to get the best I could be in my fencing was to go and train abroad. And I did that a few times and lived in different countries trying to sort of chase my dream. It was my dream to be an Olympic athlete and to win a gold medal. That's what I was trying to do. And I'd won the national championships 5 times. I'd been national championship. I was at the top of my tree, but there was a much bigger tree. And I needed to go somewhere else to train with people who were better than me. And the first time I did it was when I must have been about 21, 22 years old. And at the time, I was working for Guinness up in Park Royal in London in the control laboratory. So, you know, I'd go to work and with my lab coat and check the beer, basically, check on the fermentation process.
Oh, it wasn't a tasting job then?
There was some of that involved, which was a great part of the job. And the Swiss fencers were particularly good. And one of the fencers, when just chatting with him, he worked for Nestle in Switzerland. And went just chatting to him, and he said, well, why don't you come to Switzerland, train with us, and I'll see if I can get you a job at Nestle. And that's what I did. I went to live in Vevey on the edge of Lake Geneva, and I lived there for nearly 18 months and did my training, worked in a laboratory, which taught me lots of interesting things for later on to do with bait and nutrition and digestion. And
we were, see where it's coming together now.
Yeah, and we were particularly, the little team I worked for in the, because when I was in Guinness, it was in a control laboratory. And when I worked in Nestle, it was with a small research team. And we were researching sugars, particular types of sugars. I was working in a team with two fantastic chemists. I was just a gopher, really. But it was very interesting to see what they were doing. And I remember talking to one of the specialists, Dr. Kiefer, his name was, and saying to him, look, Dr. Kiefer, I want to know, how is it when I go fishing and I put a worm on my hook in the dark, and I cast it out into a dark lake, within a few minutes, I get a bite from a bream or a chub or a roach or whatever it happens to be. How on earth does it find it? What is it looking for? Yeah. And he said, well, it's really easy. I said, oh, good. Tell me more. And we got into some fantastic discussions. And one of the things he said was, the thing that the fish are finding are called ribonucleotides, peptides, amino acids, and they're leaching out from the worm or the maggot when you cut it, and it's releasing from the cells of the worm. And that's the smell, if you call it a smell, that's diffusing into the water, and the fish are homing in on that. And I thought, and that was the start of something really interesting. So how can I make my bait, when I was into carp fishing, how can I make my bait sort of smell a bit like that?
Yeah, kind of mimic that.
And it got me really, really into the food side and the nutritional and digestion side of bait and the importance of it to do with carp. I think what we have to remember is that whatever animal you're talking about, whether it's a fish or a rat or a bird or whatever it is, they will always take advantage of the best nutritional food they can get with the least amount of effort expended. So, you know, if you get a big hatch of something, or suddenly there's a load of crayfish in the lake that are losing their shells, or there's a big bloodworm, boom, the fish will go mad on that, and they'll take advantage of it.
Yeah, it's the convenience store.
Yeah, they want the best nutrition for the least effort expended. Yeah. So if you give the fish the best food in a nice little package, which we call a boilie, it's going to eat it, and it's going to keep coming back for it. And that's the sort of what I've tried to achieve in the bait as I've gone along, try and find out how I can achieve that within the bait that I'm producing.
Wow, you've got my brain ticking over now.
It's a vast subject. There's an awful lot of confusion about bait. I mean, I don't profess to know all about it. I'm fascinated. I've learned a lot about it. I've still got a lot to learn. But I've learned some very interesting things along the way.
You mentioned that, nutritional recognition. I know it's I say a theory, it's fact, but we know
it's fact,
that has been around for a long time. But I've always thought, when you compare it to human beings, I like to think, in most cases anyway, we're infinitely more intelligent than a carp. Most cases. I know a few that and I know what I should be eating, what is good for me and what is easy to walk to the spa 100 metres from my house to buy.
Yeah.
And I've still gone and buy a pack of Jaffa Cakes instead.
Oh, yeah, but that's the power of advertising.
And taste. And sugars.
And sugars. Yeah, that's the power of advertising. See, you can't say to a... It's like... the example I'd give you is, if you've got two plates, and on one plate you've got some nice nutritious pellets made specially for a cat. So they've got everything it needs. It's all in there. Yeah. On the other plate, you put a nice bit of fresh liver. I'll tell you which one it's going to eat first. It's pretty obvious. And if you, again, apply that to your bait to do with your fishing, You want the one that smells and tastes like the liver.
Yeah.
And then that's the one it's going to eat. It will eat the others. And the same with boilies. There's lots of companies that make good boilies. And there's quite a few that make not so good boilies. There's
quite a lot that make
but, you know, there are good baits out there, but you can make them as, I want to make it as good as it can possibly be. Yeah. So the fish will really want it and they'll really keep coming back for it. I met a very interesting scientist about, well, I don't know, 10 years ago, called Armando Pacini, an Italian guy. I'll tell you a little story about it because it's actually really interesting. I met him at the Carp Italy show. It's one of the biggest European shows. And I've been invited to do a talk about carp fishing. They'll present a conference to everybody, which is a great honour to be asked to do that.
Is, yeah.
Yeah, and I decided to do a talk about how to adapt your fishing or apply your fishing to target big fish rather than just lots of fish.
Oh, please tell me, because I've been passing out.
Well, I didn't know so much about the nutritional and the scientific side of it, I based my talk all around the things that I know through my own experience and friends' experience that works with big fish. So, for example, we'll talk about fresh bait. If you're just talking about the bait side, fresh bait, low levels of flavours, not synthetic stuff.
Yeah.
All these things will tend to catch bigger fish. The tactic, for example, that we will all have had a go at, where you'll bait heavily one area and then you'll put a spare rod or a third rod on a stringer that you chuck off the baited area. And surprise, surprise, that one rips off and it's the biggest fish in the lake, or it's the big one. And yet you catch a load of fish on the baited area. Or another example would be a great tactic for big lake fishing, where you would spread boilies on a really wide baited pattern. That tends to also pick up big fish. And my talk was based around these ideas and others along those lines, which makes you sort of, they all work. We know as carp, you know, sort of experienced carp anglers, these work, but I didn't really know why. So I did my presentation, which went down very well. And at the end, this guy that I didn't know walked up to me and said, "I want to shake your hand," in his Italian accent, because that was a really interesting talk. He said, "Stick around because I'm going to come next and I'm talking about things that will explain to you from a scientific point of view why what you just said works." And I thought, wow, so okay.
Without even planning, that's like the perfect follow-on to
it. Really was, yeah. And he actually used it in his talk as an introduction. He said, "If you listen to John Llewellyn's talk, I'm going to now explain to you why that was actually working." So I just had time to disappear and get a cold beer, get back into the stage, into the arena, and then he started his talk. And he was giving concrete examples of nutritional recognition and the way that the carp are, so the way they detect their food and how sensitive they are to certain substances, that blew my mind, really. But it also put a big tick against all those things I knew work, and it explained to me why a lot of them actually work.
Yeah. Wow, you just got me... I've lost my thread of questions now, because you've got me thinking about, you know, like my previous experiences and catches and, you know, there's one thing I've seen, you know, mentioned, you know, this is on Facebook a while. I've got my own thoughts around about bait. Air drying. I hate it. I think it takes a lot of goodness out of the bait. What do you think? I'd much rather have a fresh, recently defrosted, or even not even... been frozen.
I mean, I air dry my baits a little bit, but I agree with you. I think a freshly made bait that's just been dried enough so that it's firm is always going to be more attractive. Drying the bait out to make it last longer, especially to make it go harder, doesn't really work anyway, because as soon as it goes back in the water, it takes the water and it goes soft.
It doesn't take long, does it?
No, you can achieve the hardness in the bait by adding other ingredients to it to make it hard, to last longer. Yeah. But I'm with you. I think one of the most attractive baits you can use is paste.
Oh, yeah.
Because it diffuses so well into the water. All the attractors and stuff just leach out. They've not been cooked. I'm a great fan of a paste wrap. whether I'm using a pop-up or a balance bait or a bottom bait, a paste wrap, I think, especially for short session fishing, which is mainly what I do, and I very rarely go fishing for carp these days without a pot of paste.
Yeah, I've got two in one of these buckets down there.
Yeah, I think it's a great method.
LA, I was using like the krill paste on the folly last year and caught on it.
Yeah,
you know, just a couple of 15 mil. It was like a snowman. Wrap it in a great big ball of paste. You've got like a 40 mil ball there on the end, which looks alien to a lot of people now. With it's like 15 and 20 mil. And fine it down, but look at a carp. It's got a massive gob, and that's great nothing. Big ball
it's
of attraction.
Look at that in the corner of a 20-pounder's mouth, and it's tiny.
Yeah,
I mean, when we first before the hair rig came out, when I first fished at Taplow Gravel Pit. We were using balls that we were using paste that we moulded round our hook, so we'd use and freelining it amazingly because we thought the lead would scare the carp. So we used to freeline a big ball of paste, but a ball about the size of an orange. And one of my favourite baits of that at that time was I used to grind up pellets that I'd buy in the local shop, grind up pellets into a powder, mix it with egg. First of all, we mix it with water, but it breaks down quicker with water.
Yeah.
So we started mixing it with eggs without realising at the time that you could actually boil this thing and make it go hard. Yeah. But we made the paste with eggs, and I used to use an ingredient at the time that was called PYM, Phillips yeast mix.
Yeah.
They used to buy in little tiny tubs, and I used to put that in there as well, and nothing else. And that was a fantastic bait, and that was a great big ball of paste. And it's just and we didn't use to pre-bait either or bait up. It was literally cast it, this ball of stuff out into the lake. And sometime in the night, your silver paper would hit the butt ring and line would piss off the reel. And you'd catch a carp.
Yeah, I'm going to do that sometime just for lack of luck and just fish with little silver bits of paper or get the old washing up bottle tops so I can find them anyway.
Well, I don't know if I told you this story. Shall I tell you the story about... I did that a couple of years ago. Oh, no, it's not even that. It's I did an article about it because it was one of the most exciting things I've done for many years. It was when I was fishing at Tippings Lake, which is run by Dean Fletcher, who caught the record carp from Wasey. Yeah. He runs a lake near me called Tippings. And in the summer, it's a very shallow, lots of gravel, loads and loads of weed, and in the summer it's just stuffed with weed. It's really difficult to find sort of spots, clear spots to fish. But so middle of the summer, a couple of years ago, I wandered around Tippins, saw these fish only close in, under the weed, tenting in the weeds. Like as a kid I remember seeing them do that, and we used to fish crusts onto the top of the weed and they would tent and hump the weed until eventually you'd this crust would disappear through the weed, and you look at this carp, and all the help like this. Yeah. And I was wandering around the lake, and there were these carp just tenting in the weed. And I looked, I thought, how am I going to fish for them? I thought, well, if I was in the old days, I would have just put a ball of paste on the hook and chucked it in the weed. So I thought, right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, yeah. So I went home, and I was like a kid. I was so excited. I grabbed a rod out of my shed, tied on a size 4 hook, just took that, made up a little bit of paste.
Yeah.
Took that down the lake, big ball of paste, literally doshed it in the weed just 5 yards out in front of me, stuck it on a stick with a bit of silver paper on it.
Real treat.
Yeah, real treat, yeah. Real treat, yeah. Just a bit of silver paper and sat there like that. And I kept my waders on because it was right in the middle of a weed bed. So I knew I was going to have to get in. It's only a couple of feet deep. And about 10 minutes, the silver paper twitched, and I was like literally rubbing my hands in excitement as this silver paper sort of glided up towards the battery. And then I just struck, and hell broke loose. There's only probably a rod length of line down to where the fish was, and it was jumping the lake, get the net the weed and the fish, and this sort of mid-double came out on this thing. And I ended up going down to the lake and catching, I had half a dozen really nice fish, just fishing a ball of paste straight in the weed.
Yeah, with
the silver foil. It was so exciting, I can't tell you. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I need to do it.
You should do,
Yeah, if I was thinking about local lakes, I know exactly where I will do it as well.
Well, whoever casts out just a ball of paste into the weed.
No, and a lot of people now, they see weed and they look for a clear spot.
Well, everybody's if you think about it, everybody's obsessed by finding clear spots. I mean, I like to, I'm the same as anyone. I like to feel it cracked down onto a nice clear spot. But everybody likes to feel it cracked down onto that nice clear spot. You're fishing the same spot everyone else fishes. And the fish love the weed. They feel comfortable. That's where they find their food. Why not fish from in the weed? And in the old days, we used to do the paste on the hook. Then there was the method of which emptied everywhere when it was first used, which was a PVA bag full of pellets just doshed in the weed. In fact, I don't really see many people doing that anymore either.
This is a while since I've done it.
And yet it's such a great method. And that ball of paste in the weed, and the other thing, because you need to use strong tackle, because you're fishing in the weed, you can get away with it because they're right in the weed. They can't. Yeah. They're not really sucking and blowing at the bait like they would on a clear spot. So, I mean, when I fished at Tippins, I just used 20-pound line straight through to the hook.
Yeah,
I'm not going to let them go anywhere. and I'm sure it's a method that could be successful on lots of places.
Yeah, definitely that attraction in the paste, and it just encloses the hook, so the strike is going to be soft enough to pull the hook straight through. And
yeah, it's a good method. Yeah. Just to go back, because I know you asked me about the bait thing, and I was telling you about Armando Pacini.
Yes.
He, after his talk, we've corresponded with emails and things since, because he's just a fascinating bloke. And he's a trout fisherman. He's not a carp fisherman, but he's always been fascinated by. I think he's like a fish scientist.
I was about to say, is he some sort of scientist?
He's a fish scientist. Yeah, and he's. He has also been all his life fascinated by fish attraction, not necessarily carp, in all sorts of species. But of course, he was at the Carp Italy thing, so he was talking about carp specifically and cyprinids. And one of the things that he talked to me about that sort of blew my mind really was some studies that have been done on carp. This is done on. A group of carp that are living in a lake, so they know the number of fish and the weight of the fish.
Yeah.
And the idea was, we know from lots of studies done in the past that if the water's at about, I can't remember the exact figures, but if it's say 15 degrees centigrade, carp, the macronutrients that it needs, which is proteins, fats and carbohydrates, those three main things, I mean it needs minerals and vitamins as well, but the three macronutrients, at 15 degrees it's going to need something like 35 to 36% of protein, quite a lot of carbohydrate, and probably about 10% fat. That's just what carp need. So the experiment that was really interesting was, on this group of fish, the researchers put a big hopper, three big hoppers, over this lake, and in one of the hoppers was a pellet that was very high in protein. There was another one that was very high in carbohydrates and low in protein, and another one that was very high in fat. So you've basically got a high fat, high carbohydrate and high protein pellet. These are fish that have learnt that they're tame fish. So
there's nowhere to get the food.
Yeah, you could argue that it's not a wild situation. You know, it's not wild fish, it's tame fish, but it's still a carp. And these fish had learned that by going up to the hoppers and knocking the bottom of the hopper with their nose, it would open and the pellets would fall out. And this is the way that the researchers work out what is the best type of nutrition to give fish, whatever type of fish it is that's being grown for food, so that they get the best return on investment. So they want to spend the least they can on the pellet to get the biggest fish.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do. And there's been an awful lot of research around the world done on this for that very reason. It's a little aside, but it's possibly an important one. There was a big fuss at one point about betaine, and some people go on about betaine. Well,
yeah, I remember it, Nutribase bringing it out and did a lot of...
Yeah, it was Ken, I think it was Ken Townley. Yeah, and he had some fantastic results and he wrote about it and it became like the big thing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there are any magic ingredients. They don't exist. There's good ones and there's poor ones and there's bad ones, but there's no magic ones.
I suppose it's the formula.
It's the combination of things that is important. But the betaine thing... Betaine, the pellets, the fish farmers that are growing fish on for food, aren't going to waste their money. Now, they put a small percentage, 1% I think it is, or 1.5% of betaine into the pellets that they feed their fish with. And they wouldn't be doing that if there wasn't some reason. And the main reason, as far as I can understand from the research that I've looked into about it, is it's to do with mainly to do with digestion. It might possibly be to do with palatability, so they'll eat more. So there is something in that ingredient that helps the fish to utilise their food better and grow on. Don't quite know how I got onto betaine, but
no, we're on about the. Yeah, the fish in the pond with the three different feeds.
That's right, yeah. So you've got these three different hoppers. The fish can nudge them to get the food that they want. And there's no one to tell the fish that they're supposed to take 37% of that one.
Yeah, and they can't read, can they?
They can't read, so they don't know. So the question I'll ask you, how long do you reckon... Well, first, do they get to the point when they start to take 37 and so on? And if they do, how long do you reckon it takes them?
I honestly don't know. I would have thought they're going to, whichever one tastes nice, they're going to eat a bit like my wife in sweets. But now we know the nutritional recognition, it is a genuine thing. I'm going to think, yes, they are going to, over a period of time, but I wouldn't have thought it would be very, very quick.
Okay. Well, the research has shown that it takes the carp something like 4 to 5 days.
Days? Wow.
Yeah. To begin to feed on 37% of this one, 10% of the fat one, and the remainder of the carbohydrate. And that's studies, proper scientific studies that have shown that happens within, let's say, a week. Now, I was gobsmacked, to be honest, at that, because that basically shows that, or proves that the carp do have, as all animals do, they have this nutritional recognition, and they know what to eat and they know what's good for them. And interestingly, when the experiment was continued with water, colder water, because you wonder, okay, so what's going to happen?
I just think it's going to be variables. The environment the carp lives in changes.
Yeah, it changes throughout the year, depending on the mainly the temperature of the water, the dissolved oxygen and things, but there's the other things come in, but the main thing is the temperature of the water. So if you do, or when the experiment was repeated with water at a lower temperature, I can't remember the exact figures, I haven't got it in front of me, but I'll give you an idea. When it was around 10 degrees, the water, again, we know through lots of studies in the past that the carp need much less protein as the water temperature drops. And when the water temperature is really cold, the amount of protein they need is very low. And surprise, surprise, when they did the experiment with the water at 10 degrees, within a week, the fish were beginning to feed on a lower amount of the protein one, higher amount of the carbohydrate and the fat one. And I find that fascinating. And it really sort of stimulates my brain cells to think about how could I apply this to my bait.
Yeah, I was about to say, you're applying this science into our little round balls.
Yeah.
The question...
Yeah.
What makes the ideal boilie that is going to be attractive, nutritious, not overly filled with
carbs? How long
have
you got?
One that's they're going to eat again and again and again.
Okay. It's actually, the answer is a book. But it can also be a lot shorter than that. And the starting point has to be, what are the carp looking for, right? And so, the starting point of that is... All the carp's food, all its natural food, so whether it's a crayfish, a snail, a bloodworm, a larvae, whatever it is, it's a living animal and it needs to do something called respire, which means it's got to breathe, it's got to eat, it's got to digest its food.
Yeah.
The other thing it's got to do is it has to basically shit and piss.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's got to get rid of the stuff it doesn't need.
Yeah.
And that stuff goes into the water. So if you're a bloodworm and you're a bloodworm bed, those bloodworm are respiring. And so they're eating, they're taking in oxygen, they're metabolizing, and they're releasing into the water in the waste products partly digested food. So whatever they've, let's call it eating, whatever they've eaten, they're pushing all the waste products out into the water. And those waste products are partly digested food. So if you partly digest something that's a protein, so in their food, like our food, is made up of proteins, carbohydrates, fats, minerals, vitamins, all these other things. So when a bloodworm digests that, the protein part that it releases into the water is broken down into, keywords, ribonucleotides, peptides, amino acids. The fat part is broken down into essential fatty acids. The carbohydrates are broken down into sugars. Some of the other stuff that's released into the water would be the enzymes and the stomach part juices that are needed to break down the food, which are slightly acidic. So what it means is you get this sort of soup around the bloodworm bed, this smell of waste product released by the bloodworm. And that's the same if it's a snail or a crayfish or whatever it is. So the carp, as it gets bigger and bigger, it begins to learn that this smell of ribonucleotides, amino acids, sugars, and all these key words, that means food. So when you produce a boilie, that is releases the same sort of chemical signals that stimulate the carp senses, and it gives it the nutrition that it needs, you're onto a winner.
Yeah, it's all kind of like coming together now.
And that is the sort of the basis of how I look at the way that I make my bait. I want it to, the key part of the bait is the base mix. And if the base mix itself is releasing those signals that I'm talking about, that is going, the carp recognizes that that will be a food, will give it the nutrition it wants. And we know from the studies that within a week or so, it will recognize that as being a really good food.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, and it's logical, and it's actually, it's not just bullshit. It is actually stands up with scientific facts.
Yeah, and the old term establishing a bait has been around forever.
You can't do better than if you give it a if you put a food bait in and you apply it on a regular basis, the carp will begin to recognise it and they will begin to search it out.
Yeah, I've done it myself before on a few lakes, and I remember the first time I did it, there's myself and a friend, Darren. We bought, I'll tell you what it was. It was when the mainline brought the original Grange out. You know, we got a tinky bucket apiece and, you know, your little dip, some milky toffee, because I think we'd seen it in a Dave Lane article somewhere. That was the one. And remember what we used to do? We'd make a 20-head mix in his shed every Monday night, split it up into four, which I know by nowadays is not a lot of bait,
but
we'd split it up into four, and he'd bait up on a Tuesday, I'd bait up on a Thursday. And then for a couple of nighters at the weekend, we'd have a bag each to fish with. And just by keeping that steady trickle going in, we smashed it.
You will do. Yeah, the fish will actually, they will search out your bait. It's a fascinating subject, and it, I mean, it sort of leads us on a little bit to the other part of the bait thing, which is, okay, so you've got this lovely nutritional food, which is the base mix. It could be some of the additive, you know, extracts and things, but it's mainly the base mix. So for our carp base, we add in a flavour.
Yeah.
And we might add in a few other things. And the first thing I'd say is that if you've got this lovely food, you can very easily ruin that lovely food by putting a poor flavour with it, or putting a flavour in that's too strong.
Yeah, I would have thought a lot of the maybe artificial synthetic flavours could easily ruin a good boilie.
I think so, yeah, because the baits that are, or the flavours that are based on natural ingredients are ingredients and basically chemicals that the fish recognise as being something that they know. If it's synthetic, that gets onto something which is really interesting as well. Again, Armando, in his talk, he talked about this. He talked about why the spread baiting pattern can be so successful for a big fish, or why the rod fished off a baited area tends to pick up the bigger fish. And my ears pricked up when he said he was going to talk about that.
Ears are just pricked up because two scenarios I've encountered several times. So.
Yeah, and there's a reason. There's lots of factors in all of this. Yeah. And there's no sort of magic bullet, but there is an explanation, and the explanation is along these lines.
Yeah.
When the fish is small, so if you're looking at a baby carp, you know, just let's call it a small carp, a young carp.
A pasty.
a pasty, even smaller. He doesn't know what's good for it. He hasn't got his mum to say, you've got to eat this and you've got to eat that. He's got to find out for himself. He might follow the adults and eat stuff that they eat, but basically, small fish will try a bit of anything. So on the first thing is they don't know yet what's good nutritionally for them, so they'll try anything until they work out what's good. The second thing is that they is to do with their taste buds that they have. Carp are incredibly sensitive, or cyprinids are incredibly sensitive creatures. They have to be, because they've got to find the right nutritional food. They're as sensitive as a trained spaniel that will, somebody who's touched a bomb and washed their hands and had two showers and touched their steering wheel, the dog can smell it on the steering wheel. A carp are just as sensitive. But when they're small, so when they're small carp, their taste buds that are in their mouth, on their barbules, on their skin, on their head, they've got little on their nose, the little holes above their mouth, which is their nasal passages, they're full of taste buds. And a small carp has a large number of taste buds per square centimetre, but compared to a big carp, it hasn't got anything like the same number. And we'll sort of come to that in a second. So they've got taste buds, but they haven't got lots and lots of them. Also, because they're a small fish, the volume of skin with the taste buds on is relatively small.
Yeah.
So they're relatively insensitive, and they don't know what they're looking for. As they grow, the two things happen. They begin to learn that this particular smell of these ribonucleotides and amino acids and so on represents food. And secondly, they get bigger, so there's more square centimetres for them to taste things, and the number of taste buds per square centimetre increases. So if you then apply that, and that continues as they grow until they stop growing and they just become an old fish. So if you apply that to a big fish, a 30, 40 pounder or something, or bigger, it's been around a while, it becomes blinkered almost to what it knows is good to eat. And anything that falls outside that and doesn't smell as it expects it to, it might pick up out of curiosity, but most of the time it won't. Especially if when it's done it in the past, it's had a cuddle with a smelly carp angler. So there's two things that are coming into play, and so they become more and more blinkered, looking for the right nutrition. They're not going to waste their energy and their effort eating something that isn't going to do them any good. The way they detect whether it's any good, there's two things that happen. In their nasal passages, they have taste buds that are particularly sensitive to the things we've just talked about, the ribonucleotides and so on. And they can smell, as the fish moves through the water, it can smell or detect, let's call it detect, those chemicals in the water from quite a long way away. It doesn't have to actually pick the bait up to know that the smell from that thing smells like food. And the smells are all those natural things that we've just talked about. So it smells that through its nasal passages mainly to start with. It will swim towards the smell and follow the concentration line of the smell towards where it's most concentrated. And when it gets close, it opens its mouth and gills and it sucks it in into its mouth. Now, carp are fantastically good at, they have to be, at taking into their mouth a load of crap off the bottom. So they take in a load of bloodworm, a load of sticks and stones and weeds and stuff. They, interestingly, what they do, Armando explained this to me, and again, I found this fascinating because you can't see what's happening. But when the carp opens its mouth and it sucks the bait into its mouth, its tongue at the bottom of its mouth forces the food in its mouth against the roof of its mouth. And the roof of its mouth is called the palate. And the palate is where the biggest concentration of taste buds are. And what it's doing, it's doing two things. It crushes the food, or boily, or whatever it is, against the roof of its mouth, so that it's pushing it against the taste buds. And it's in a split second, is assessing whether this is a nice food to eat or not. The other thing it does is, again in a split second, while it's holding the food against the roof of its mouth, it you've seen carp opening and closing their mouth and their gills going. Yeah. What they're doing is called backwashing, and they're pushing water in and out of their mouth to wash out all the silt and crap whilst they hold the food items against the roof of their mouth.
Yeah.
They're also detecting whether it's worth eating. Let's say it is. They've got rid of the crap. They open their back of their throat. Down it goes, past the pharyngeal teeth, and it's eaten. So, to apply that to what we were saying about the spread baiting pattern, or low levels of flavour, or the rod outside the baited area, if you've got a boil, if you take a kilo of boilies and you drop them on a fairly tightly baited spot, even if they're boilies that are at the right level of flavour for it to be a good food, the leach off of flavours and attractors from that bait is quite strong.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just take one boilie and you on its own, the leach off is quite low. Now the smell coming from a lot of bait is relatively strong. For a little fish, it doesn't smell strong, and so they dive in.
Yeah.
For a big fish, especially a wary one that's been caught a few times, to him, he might want to eat it because it smells like nice food, but he's very wary. He knows there's something going on. So what does he do? He picks up the odd boilie around the outside because they don't smell so strong to elicit a new smell, but they're not as strong. And that's one reason why the bait off the baited area works, and it's the same reason why the spread bait pattern works, because the release of these elements into the water is a lot weaker. The big fish isn't scared by the strong smell. It'll come in and start feeding. It'll recognise it's good food, and it'll continue to feed. And the other thing that makes that work so well is not only is it then feeding more confidently, because it, the more it eats, the more it becomes confident, but it's moving from boily to boily, to, and it's swimming to find the food. And because it's swimming, your rig's going to work better.
Yeah,
it sucks it's it a in, moving fish. And it's a moving fish, you're going to hook it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I explained that well, but basically, to me, when that was just a small part of his talk and a small part of the things that I've talked about with Armando that have changed my carp fishing and given me loads of confidence to apply what I do and make my bait the way I do, because I know it works, and it's not, I now have some logic behind it as to why it's working, and that also helps me in researching, developing new stuff, because I know the roads I want to go down. I love it, it's great.
Yeah, what was it called? Armando
Piccini.
Because I'm gonna Google him.
Google him. Yeah, Google him. You'll have to speak Italian. But
oh, I might struggle. I can.
You can always use Google Translate.
Yeah, it's a bit
like Chinese.
Yeah, I know gelato. That's ice cream.
Gelato.
That's about my limit of Italian.
A beer.
Yeah, a beer. But. Yeah, well, we've been going over an hour. That was
cool, dear. I can talk a lot, can't I?
Yeah, that's flown by. That's fascinating.
Good.
You know, big thanks for talking to us. We've been on a bit of a journey to the Olympics, to Italy, and around the pharyngeal teeth.
No, it's been fun. It's been interesting, and thanks for inviting me onto the Carpcast.
No,
it's brilliant.
Loved it. Oh, you're welcome, John. And before we go, do you want to give your company, Big Carp, a little plug? Let people know if anyone's been interested in this sort of thing, where they can buy all this science in a little round ball.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're a sort of off the radar company, really. We're a small company based in Reading. Quality is the name of the game. We make bait to order, so we don't keep anything in the freezers, because I think that you asked about that. It's all fresh. So orders come in, we roll it to order. It's all based on the food nutritional recognition that I've talked about. We use John Baker's flavours. You will have heard about John Baker. I know you had him on the Carpcast. So we're using good nutritional bait, excellent flavours at the right level. It's just bait that catches fish. And I want you to go out and catch loads of fish. In fact, I want you to catch one right now. Can you do that?
Come on. No, I think I've failed in my attempt to... catch one live. It'll happen sooner or later.
If people are interested and they want to get in touch with me, it's really simple. They can go on to the website. It's bigcarp.com. And the easiest way to get me is just to email me. Again, it's very simple. info@bigcarp.com.
Wow, even I can do that. Well, thanks again, John Llewellyn.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
Well, I think John is one of the nicest and politest people I've spoken to on the Carpcast, and most knowledgeable as well. I hope everyone got a little bit from that.
You were worried about him going a bit too technical, but as we know from the Frank Warwick chats and stuff, the more technical people go, the more our listeners like it. So I hope you have all gained something from that.
Yeah, I definitely have. It's made me think a lot more about bait, and I think as you know, at the end, you are going to mention his big carp bait company. He doesn't want to be massive. He's just like, it's his passion, it's what he does. You know, he's not a businessman, he makes top quality bait. In fact, that weekend, what's I have to say, we fished Sunday night and Monday night, but you know, the weekend previous there was a few people on the lake and there'd been three caught, and John came down, gave me a bag of his bait, and even I caught five. Then I think he ended up with about seven or eight, including one of the lake's biggest at just over £40.
Wow.
Knowledge.
Yeah, we spoke about this before. I mean, you know, it is a science. And the more I speak to people about bait, the more I realise I know absolutely nothing. You know, there is, yeah. You know, when we've had Mark Holmes on talking about esters and the alcohol, and a lot of people seem to say the same things now when we speak to people and know what they're talking about. So, it's a rabbit hole. I've got enough things that I'm interested in my life without going down the bait rabbit hole. because I can go geeky on stuff when I get into things, so I'd rather trust other people to do it. But if you went down that hole and you found something that carp just could not resist, and every time you put it out every fish in the lake swam to it, I don't think fishing would be fun if you just caught every fish in the lake every time you went fishing. I mean, you know,
it's to find out.
Yeah, but once, I mean, it even happened to us in France. You know, I had a bit of a red letter week in France. As I say, Reedy and Spenny caught up on their swim. They had a 24-hour period where it went off for them. But I was getting to the point where I was putting less rods out. You know, so one night I only had two rods out in open water because of the hassle of what I was doing in the end is my two rods that were like long 250, 300 yards going over to the pads. It was such hard work landing the fish that I wasn't fishing those rods at night, just because I didn't want to go out that distance in a boat, you know, fighting my way through the pads with a head torch, tracing the line, you know, to maybe catch a mid 30, 40 and unhook it in the water, drop the rod again and go back to do it all again, you know, a few hours later. Like I'd caught enough mid-30s to not, you know, it was like, I'm catching enough. I know when I put the rod out, it's going to go. I don't think I put a rod out on them pads at any point that didn't go. It was just a case of where you put it was how long it took to go. And at that point, for me, I mean, that's why I fish a lot of low-stock lakes over the years. Putting a rod out where you just know you're going to get a bite, like maybe fishing somewhere like Drayton or, you know, the absolute runs waters, it's great for the first 10 fish, and then after that, like, the challenge is gone for me. So I don't think I'd enjoy it if there was like a wonder bait that you just guaranteed to catch or whatever, because some days you want to go and catch a load of fish, but when it isn't actually hard to catch fish, that goes out the window for me. And I know some people, they just want to catch loads and as many as they can, you know, but that's why I'm generally a big fish low stock angler. I'd like, if you just know, if I put a rod on that spot, I'm going to get a bite within the hour. Where's the challenge? I don't know. But that's me. Obviously, fishing's different to different people. I don't know.
I suppose when you're talking about where you've just been, it's your enjoyment. You're on holiday. It's not an endurance test. So I don't blame you. I might even put the rods in at night and just fished it the day if it's really going off all the time.
Yeah, well, what I was doing, I actually got a couple of open water spots going to my left, bearing in mind most of the fish were coming out the pads. And I actually had, the first night that I fished it, I poured a bucket of bait on, I made a little video of it actually, it's like on a marker stick, sort of halfway across the lake, and knowing that I could land the fish from the bank, so there was no boat hassle, so the two rods that I had on the pads at distance, I was bringing them in at night. And just having the two rods in the open water, pre-baited for a couple of days and then put rods in it. And then the first night that rod went twice, went at 3 a.m, then like an hour later after I put it back out. And I had a 48 and a scraper 40, it was the two biggest fish in the session at the time, off that spot. And I do sometimes think you catch the bigger ones fishing like that. So that was my goal after that. I wanted to try and catch one of the lumps on the 60s or 50s, which I didn't manage to do. But, you know, that became my challenge, was, right, I know I can catch fish down there on the pads. And obviously, if you don't put the rod out and then the open water rod doesn't go and you don't catch a fish overnight, I then wanted to get a bite. So I'd put the rods back on the banker spots. And then, you know, once they're both gone, I was like, right, I've caught another couple now. Let's concentrate on trying to catch a big one. But it's different. Somewhere I do want to go do a bit of time is Clearwater Fisheries. Clearwater are sponsor of the Carp Cast. They've got a few lakes down there, including a Runswater, which I haven't caught a fish out of yet, but I've been doing some tuitions on there and I will be going back there soon. Shout out to Carl Gibbs, who had a tuition on with me there. I spoke to him yesterday actually, seeing if he fancies going back. I'm going to go and do a night or two with him, because we went in the bleakness of winter when it was freezing cold and we didn't catch nothing. So while he might have learnt a few bits, I said I'd take him back there again in the summer. So I'm looking forward to going back up to Clearwater. There's been quite a few fish getting caught out of there. Heapy Bob's been posting quite a few of the fish. Don't know if you've seen any of them, Mark. At some point we'll get a Carpcast social up there. Still haven't managed to sort a date out there yet, but I'm going to, because I've been chatting with Alex about doing some sort of summer school for kids up there. Kevin Nash is looking at getting involved with Alan Blair. So many good things happening up at Clearwater. My favourite chef, there used to be a fishery in Blackpool called Four Seasons, it's still there but it's syndicate now and not day ticket, and they had an amazing cafe on site. John was the chef. John used to be chef at the De Vere, which is the posh hotel in Blackpool, and he's a fantastic chef. And Alex has nicked him, he's working up at Clearwater now, so even more reason to go up there. The food is amazing, the fishing is fantastic. You can get your name down if you're interested in the syndicate for next year, is extending the lakes, putting islands in, and spent thousands and thousands on fish, and the place is going to be one of the finest fisheries in the country. And you might see us down there, and hopefully we'll get a Carpcast social on there soon. So yeah, clearwaterfisheries.co.uk is the website. Heapy Bob's always sharing their stuff on our Carpcast pages. I advise you to go and have a look. Fancy a scram down there at some point, Mark? We'll get a couple of nights.
Ooh, maybe. I'm not... I'm not going to promise anything at the minute, because I've got that monk's pit ticket that I've not really utilised yet, and I want to spend some time down there. But you keep talking about Clearwater, I keep seeing these pictures, it's going to be hard to resist.
Yeah, have you been on monks the last couple of weeks?
I was down there for a couple of nights last week, and it wasn't fishing particularly well. There was quite a lot of fish up in the shallows, and they were stitched up, to be honest. So did a 91 swim, there was fish near me but not close enough. Yeah, moved to the swamp that I think the Don's made famous with his raves. There was one or two fish, you know, the warm wind was pushing in there. There was one or two fish that had come down on the wind, and I'm thinking, I'm in with a shout here, but come the morning, the wind had changed, it was blowing down the shallows, and there was nothing there. But even though there was fish in the shallows and anglers all around it, there wasn't that many caught. So I think they're just getting ready for spawning their once a year orgy.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of spawning posts on the net recently. It does seem that most anglers are aware now that you shouldn't really fish for spawning fish. You know, you quite often get a duffer's week where the fish are gathering up ready to spawn, but most lakes know better now that they ought to be closing, when the fish start to do their business.
Did you see the videos that they put up from Cromwell of the fish spawning in front of the house?
I did, yeah. Helen was posting stuff. They don't normally spawn in front of the house, do they? So, yeah, I saw... I love watching videos and pictures of fish, and obviously with technology that we're seeing a lot more stuff now, aren't we, with underwater cameras and whatever. And but you didn't really need anything there, were they? They're in the clear water off the house, and yeah,
I'm sure they were sat on the deck in having a barbecue and watching the fish spawn.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Oh, I know something we hadn't mentioned yet. We've been quite long on this one, haven't we? So we'll wrap this up pretty quick, and we will get round to doing the listeners' questions episode. We've got a ton of questions. You can add to that as well. But yeah, did you see what went on at Walthamstow?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Oh, a bit of a fish kill.
That's yeah.
Hosts.
A fish kill, and it kind of happened with one of these carp fishing matches. I think as they turned up to fish and do the draw and everything, fish were floating up dead, and somebody made the decision to continue fishing.
Stress out fish that are already stressed.
Exactly, yeah. The lake has now been closed, but I understand things from a business point of view. If you know, if the venue's taking a load of money off, because it's not cheap to hire venues, you know, it's always over £1,000 and sometimes a lot considerably more. You know, if there's a chain, isn't there? If like the event organizer has taken money off anglers, he's then paid that money to a venue, and then something goes wrong. You know, it's a bit of a ball ache to kind of undo all that. You know, there's a commitment, but the fish must come first. You know, if you're turning up to a lake and the fish are floating up and fish floating past, which is, I believe, what was happening, you've got to knock it on the head there and then. You know, there clearly was a serious problem, which is why the lake is now closed. I don't want to lay any blame, but somewhere between the event organiser and the fishery, I think somebody should have made the decision not to continue fishing. When there's a match on a lake, it stresses the lake out anyway. You know, it's generally a lot higher pressure. You know, when you've got a load of capable anglers trying to catch a fish within a very short period of time for competition, you know, it's the hardest that lake gets fished during any particular season. You know, I've been in a few of these matches and witnessed them, you know, and they're trying different methods. Everybody's competing against the next guy. You're fishing 24 hours a day as hard as you can possibly fish. You know, there's regular baiting. It's just, it ups the stress factor of the lake infinitely. And when the fish are already in distress, tut-tut, whoever was responsible for that. I'm not laying the blame at any one person, but I don't think that was cricket, do you?
No, not really. But I would one thing I would add, not to the Walthamstow, but anyone with fisheries or involved, certainly keep an eye on them, especially the oxygen levels at the minute with the hot weather we've had. All the fish are spawning, which puts them under extra stress. A lot of places are really weedy, which has an effect. And also, we had one in Doncaster yesterday. Proper monsoon thunderstorms come over. And they can be oxygen crashes this time of year, so
kills the pressure, doesn't it? When you get a low pressure in the summer, those summery storms come in, it kills the oxygen in the water. Be vigilant if you own a lake. I'm sure you know way more about fishing than I do, but it's that time of year where extra special eye needs to be kept on the lakes. Did we give a shout out to Roger, by the way, catching my fish?
No, we didn't, but shout out to Roger for catching his fish, apparently, because you didn't catch it.
Yeah, he caught the big common, the wood carving, 57, I think it was. So it's obviously been moved
what
to
a
the...
good looking fish.
It looked fantastic. They're the best pictures I've ever seen of it as well, Roger's pictures. He caught it off the top on the side, hooked boily. Key cray, I think.
Old
school. He got an opportunity, went hot, saw the fish on the top, put a load of mixes in, and Alan Blair said that's exactly how we'll catch it. That fish loves a floater, and that's exactly what happened. He spent a couple of hours trying to catch it, and he caught it. So, yeah, well done to Roger. And so I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to fish for that fish now, because it's gone in Nash's new lake. That he's dug. And I don't think that'll be fish for a few years, so maybe I'll get a chance in a few years' time, I don't know. But yeah, there is a...
70 by
there is still a handful of fish in the lake. The there's about five left, I think, but there potentially is a mid 40 and a 50 in that, so I'm going to, Nashie wants all the fish out of there, so I will attempt to fish it, some proper low stock fishing. I will endeavour to have a go. I've got a load of dates on the Church Lake now. I did mention a few weeks ago that I've got a few spaces on the Church Lakes on weeks where there is nobody on. I do have those dates now. I've messaged all the people that had already messaged me previously, giving them first refusal, because I did mention it a few weeks ago. So if you would like it, I think I've got, there's a couple of spaces left in June. I think I've got one space left in August. I think it's like the 25th. I've got all of November. I've got, there's a couple of weeks in October, and I think there might be a couple of spaces left in the middle of September. So the price is £5.50. It's from Monday to Friday. You get all my expertise. I know those lakes pretty damn well now. Fish them a lot. So I'll help you with rigs, methods, spots and whatever. It's not coaching as it is, but you know, I'm going to make sure everybody catches. And I think there's what, 550s in the Church Lake, maybe 25-40s, and pretty much everything else is a good 30. There are some of the nicest looking fish in the country. Put it this way, there's more 40s than there is 20s in there. The only 20s in there now are either the beautiful fish that have stocked from Viv Shears, the handpicked ones, or ones that have actually bred in there. They're pretty much the only 20s. But yeah, I remember, do you remember when Jerry Hammond had 940s in 2 days out of there quite a few years ago? I think my best is 440s in the session on there, but yeah, if it kicks off 1 week, and we've got some decent weeks, got a couple of new moon weeks, if it kicks off, then there could be some serious hits. There will never be more than three anglers plus me. If you try and book that lake yourself, it's for up to six people, and it's £3,000, so £550 for a maximum of four people, we'll give you all the help and tips we can. So yeah, get in touch if you would like it. You might even see Kevin or Alan while you're up there. You might be able to get a chance to say hello. It's very possible. But yeah, hit me up if you want that. I think we've been long enough, Mark. Now, Mark, we'll do a show, which is just listeners' questions, clear the backlog. But as we hadn't knocked a show out for a couple of weeks, and you had John Llewellyn's interview, I thought we might as well do that one.
Now you've actually returned to the real world.
Well, this 4G, this is the first time we've done this Skype on 4G, and it seems to have been successful. You've been loud and clear all the way through it, so I'm very confident that during the European trip that I'm doing, that we will be able to keep the Carpcast rolling out, which I was a bit worried about. I didn't want to not do one for 4 or 5 weeks, but I think we're going to be fine. So, this test run did it.
Yeah, it's to be honest, it's not much been much different from the usual. At this end, you've come across loud and clear, and that's about it. It does seem to have worked.
Cool. Well, thank you for listening. Tight lines. Hope you catch loads of fish. Don't fish for spawning fish, and the next time you get out, they should be all finished. So until next time, catch you later.
www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.